It really is. Not yet.
Is that Susan? Is that Susan back there? Oh, that's why we're having such a good time. We haven't seen you in such a long time. All right, it's just a little bit after 6, so let me call the meeting to order. And Zenaida, would you like to take roll call, please?
Sure. Councilmember Aston Nielsen. Councilmember Dragoni.
Here.
Councilmember Marmahoko.
Here.
Councilmember Roll.
Here.
Councilmember Stanley. Councilmember Cushman.
Here.
Chair Weidler.
Here.
We have a quorum.
Okay, thank you. If we can all stand and do the Pledge of Allegiance, please. All right, next on our agenda is public announcements. This is open time for the public to speak on any item which they would like. There's a 3-minute limit and a 3-minute limit. So, do we have any speakers?
Officer Tyler Cefalu. Yes. Officer Tyler Cefalu.
Good evening. I'm Officer Tyler Cefalu out of the CHP Hayward office. I'm filling in for Officer Paps today. She cannot be with us. She's taking care of a family matter, so I'm here on her behalf. I'll do the best I can to be as good as she is, but bear with me. The stats for May for the Eden area, we issued 407 citations. 34 vehicles were impounded out of the entire area. 16 people were arrested for DUI. There was one felony arrest, 4 misdemeanor arrests, and those between the one felony and the 4 misdemeanor, those are outside just a regular DUI arrest. There was 48 non-injury crashes, 22 injury crashes. There was one vehicle versus bicyclist, but no vehicle versus just pedestrians just walking. There was a bicyclist versus vehicle. I don't have details on that, but the bicyclist, it says here, it was the whoever was riding the bike was at fault for the crash. Again, I don't know what the details are about that one. We do have a new specially marked patrol vehicle. Is it a gray? It's a gray Dodge Durango. You might see it on 880, 580, 238. It's limited to the freeways. It has to be limited to multi-lane freeways, so it won't be on any city streets. The city street cars will be your regular black and white patrol vehicles, the all white Charger, and I think one of the officers has the all white Explorer as well. We do have traffic complaints that the Castro Valley officers are handling. The Kipp Elementary School traffic complaint in Hillside Elementary School. I worked Hesperian today. Hesperian's my area of focus. I was out there from about 10 to 3 and issued 20 citations just in that time. 11 of those were seatbelt, 3 or 4 for speed, and some miscellaneous other things. We did have a maximum enforcement period last weekend for the entire Hayward area, but it was statewide as a department as well. Upcoming events that she has listed here, August 5th is National Night Out. And then upcoming educational events, June 17th from 10 to 12, we have an Age Well Drive Smart class at Lake Elizabeth in Fremont. And June 24th from 6 to 8 is Start Smart at CHP Hayward for the juveniles that are learning to drive or getting tickets taken care of. That is all I have on here. Any questions for me?
Thanks. I saw an all burgundy.
I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. There are no
No questions
questions
during the
during
comment period.
public comment. Yeah, apologies.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
You can go ahead and speak after. If you could please fill out the slip so we have you on record.
Well, I'll do that afterwards.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for convening and making sure you have a full quorum. I'm really pleased to see this is still an active board and council. I wanted to just take a moment to recognize the passing of Basil Sherlock, who was a community member who started our, he's one of the founding members of the community organization, the Trailand Community Association. And for a long time, he and his wife and a bunch of other people in the community were really pushing forward to actually be the initiators of this board that you've got, this council that you have now. So I just want to recognize his passing and honor his work that he did for the community. And I think he was 92 years old, so a lot of time spent, you know, in the community, although he moved away some time ago and there was some contention about his remaining on our board and all that. But aside from that, he was really, really very thoughtful, conscientious member of the community. Anyway, just to give him honor and pay some respects to him. The other thing I wanted to announce is I'll leave these flyers up here, but our next meeting on the 12th, this next Thursday, from 6 to 8 p.m., going to be held over here at the Community Center. And it's put together by the Public Works Agency and the Community Arts Council. And it's going to be a presentation of the artist candidates who are going to be presenting their work in person for the community to come and look at and see the kind of work they do. And then the selection committee will pick the artists that will be involved with the public art that's going to go in with the renovation of the street, the corridor. So I'll leave these out here. There's a little, if you can't make the meeting, there's a little QR code here, I guess. You can look at that and you can put your, you know, own comments. So be sure you get this on your phone. The other thing is a little flyer I'll leave here for saving the SkyWest open space. There's also a petition to sign and share on here. That's a community, you know, thing that really everybody should look at it at least. And so it's sort of to support that. And I'll just release back my, oh, I don't know if I can ask him a question, but generally I'd like to know how the new CHP, you know, progress is going with that on the Jackson thing. Did you have any information on that? The progress? You don't know. Okay. Anyway, we need to look forward to that being a real good distribution area. Thank you.
Just one thing too, real quick. There's a flyer over there. There's going to be, through the Eden Chamber, the San Lorenzo Business Alliance is meeting 1 to 2 p.m. on Thursday. That'll be June 12th also. It's at Angry Goose Games, a new business that we've been trying to support. It's right next to Frodo Joe's. So please come out and support that if you can. Thank you so much.
I just want to clarify that the public roundtable for the Arts Commission for the streetscape on Mission Boulevard, on Mission Boulevard, is going to be held tomorrow night at our CCA meeting. This is Tuesday. Thursday night, because you said next Thursday. I'm getting it wrong too, so sorry. Thursday the 12th, 6 to 8 at the Trailand Community Center. Thank you.
No more speakers on public comment.
One more speaker.
I'm sorry, you put item number one. I had just, okay.
Yeah, if you look at what it says below that, I'd also like to talk about the following areas. My name is Michael Moore. I live in Ashland. I've been property owner there for the last 35 years. The Alameda County Public Works Administration is going to ask for voters to authorize money to be spent to keep everybody from flooding. What they won't cover is why I wanted to just bring it up. And that is, they don't cover any of the maintenance or any of the repair to the storm sewers, which is a major source of backup. When I checked with the county, after talking with Public Works, they say that that is up to Public Works to address all of that. My concern is that a cause of flooding is not going to be addressed by the flood control district. The other thing that I'd like to just bring up is that we're almost ready to reopen or open a brand new park in Ashland. I know you sent out a notice saying, what's the name going to be? But I haven't heard anything. It looks to me like it's going to open soon, and I look forward to it. I live right across from it. Thank you.
Sandra, you're on the line. You have 3 minutes.
Hello, can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay. I really wanted to talk about the liquor store that came up for a CPU last week. I really wanted to shout out the MAC for really listening to the community, especially our youth leaders, and just voting that down. I know that there is a consideration for businesses and things like that, but it is so important to really think about the health and of the community, about what kind of businesses we want to bring. I did notice that there is like an item on the agenda that kind of touches on this today, but I did just want to really talk about what it meant to the kids that you guys listen to them, and also the consideration that you took. I also wanted to take a moment to talk about why it's so important that we, you know, keep these types of businesses and control the density around liquor stores in our community. Something that I kind of thought about that I didn't bring up at the time is that, you know, that liquor store is going to be located, if it is approved through the BZA or whatever, actually next to one of our community identifiers. It's right next to the overpass that says Ashland and Cherryland. I was actually on the committee that the artist selection committee for that community identifier, and it is the entrance into Ashland. And I think that we should really consider, like, do we want a liquor store to be the face of Ashland? And I don't think that we do. And density around liquor stores is an issue. It was the TRL around tobacco control was also brought up, and whether there's one around alcohol or not. And I will say that the density control policy for tobacco has actually been really successful in the unincorporated area. That's one that we also championed. It really requires, I think it's 2,500 residents per one tobacco outlet. And because we do have that density control, what's been happening is that when stores go up for sale and the new owner takes over, they actually can't get a license for tobacco. So what happens is that we have been reducing stores that way, and we've actually closed 4 tobacco retailers in that way through the density control policy. And so we are looking to mimic that success with alcohol. That's why we were doing the community assessments that we mentioned at the time. And so I just wanted to give a little bit of context. Sorry if it's a little long, but I just really think it's important for everybody to consider how the businesses we bring into our community, how alcohol density is an issue in our community, especially in Ashland, and really take the time to shout out this MAC for listening to the community and doing the right thing and voting against having that business there. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
No more speakers.
Okay, so public comment is closed.
I just had one quickie.
Another comment?
Yes.
A quickie. Sorry, so let me reopen public comment for one more speaker.
The officer, did he stick around? No.
He's there.
No, you are there. I was hoping that in your recitation of the stats that they could be a little bit more relatable to the communities that are involved, specifically the maximum enforcement. Were the results of that included within all of the statistics that you read in the beginning? So
okay.
Just being able to relate everything to the community, where they occurred, and all of that in relatively real time.
Okay, thank you. Right, so public comment is closed. We'll go on to approval of the minutes. We have copies of the
Chair, I'm sorry. I just received more of these. So we do have one more.
One more speaker.
Okay.
Thank you.
Just a point of order for public comment. I think I run into this too when I go to the Hayward City Council subcommittee meetings. There's no sign that actually shows the order or procedure, what people are supposed to do, where the comment cards are, if comment cards are required. I just think we could be a little bit more clear on what is required to be able to speak. I don't know if that includes a sign. I don't know if that includes an announcement before, that sort of thing.
All right. The minutes from Tuesday, May 13th, we have copies of those. Are there any corrections, additions, or is anyone ready to make a motion to accept the minutes from May 13th? Any comments or?
No, I move that we approve.
Okay, there's a motion to approve. Is there a second?
I second.
All right, thank you. So there's a motion and a second to approve the minutes. Is there any discussion? Okay, we should take a roll call vote. Mm-hmm.
Councilmember Aston Nielsen?
Approved.
Councilmember Dragoni?
Yes.
Councilmember Marumahoko?
Approved.
Councilmember Roll?
Yes.
Councilmember Stanley?
Yes.
Councilmember Cushman?
Yes.
Chair Weidler?
Yes.
Approved.
All right, on our regular calendar, the first item is an informational item regarding the Economic Development Strategic Plan. And I think the presenter is Dina Belzer, is that correct? Okay.
Hi, I'm Jamie Orfanos with Alameda County's Economic and Civic Development Department. And I just wanted to thank you all for having us here tonight. Of course, you're going to meet Dina Belzer in a moment. And also we have Susan McHugh here. She's our former assistant director and she is working on this project as well. We're very excited to have Dina here tonight. We have already gone to the Castor Valley MAC. And tonight, of course, we're presenting to the Eden MAC, and I wanted to specifically say thank you to Tyler Dragoni and Elizabeth Stanley for their work on our economic development subcommittee that has been formed and has been working on this whole, approximately 9 months now. And so tonight is the first introduction to the full MAC of the culmination of those efforts. And of course, as I mentioned, we have Dina Belzer here from Strategic Economics, a longtime, very knowledgeable consultant that has worked with many jurisdictions in the East Bay and elsewhere on similar efforts as this one. And I hope you find this presentation really informative. Thank you.
I'm very short. Thanks, Jamie. And good evening to you all. Again, I'm Dina Belzer with Strategic Economics, and I have had the pleasure of working with several of you. It's been great. So I'm looking forward to this presentation tonight. So next slide, please. Great. Tonight, I have six topics that I want to talk to you about. First, I'll introduce the project overall so you know what it is we're doing and what it is we're talking about. And then we'll show you some demographic analysis. This is basically who lives in the unincorporated areas of urban unincorporated areas of Alameda County. The next section we'll be discussing what about the commercial real estate. We're really focused on the major arterial corridors, which are the places where most of the economic activity occurs in the unincorporated areas of the county. Then we'll be talking about opportunity sites and key nodes within the Eden sub areas. You have several of them, and we'll give you a kind of a taste of what's coming up in terms of the economic development strategy itself, the document. So sort of just an overview or introduction to the outline, and give you a quick wrap up of next steps. So next slide, please. Next slide, please. Thank you. So there are three key goals for this presentation. One is to support new commercial activity, and we'll show you a little bit more about where we're working on this. But this is really intended to increase the quality of the unincorporated communities so you feel more like communities, so you have a focal point. We want to encourage investment in these areas so that your, again, your commercial districts feel vibrant and active. And finally, we want to give county staff and the MACs a clear roadmap or implementation strategy for moving these concepts forward. So next slide, please. So when we talk about unincorporated Alameda County, you all know what the Eden subarea encompasses. It's the areas of Ashland, Cherryland, San Lorenzo, and Hayward Acres. And then Castro Valley is its own thing. And Fairview, I believe, is actually part of Eden, right? We discussed this last time. So we mistakenly left it off this list here, but we're primarily focused on Ashland, Cherryland, and San Lorenzo, because these are the places that have the commercial corridors. So we'll look at that in a second. Next slide, please. We have a process and a timeline focused on these four phases. The first is sort of who we are. And again, we focus mostly at the demographics, who lives in these areas, because the population and to a smaller extent, the workforce who work in these areas are the people who are going to support the businesses that we're trying to attract to the area. And then the second phase is what's the condition of our buildings? So this is really the where are we looking at? What are the places that we're focused on? Our third phase is where can we grow? So these are these opportunity sites, which we'll be discussing in more detail later in the presentation. And then finally, how do we move forward with implementation? So we really worked through all the data analysis primarily through January, February earlier this year. And now we're moving into that final phase of implementation. So we expect to be back with you probably in July. So just so you know, we have referenced all of the background materials to look at all the work that's already been done for the unincorporated areas, including the Eden Area General Plan and the Sunol Downtown Revitalization Plan. We didn't want to reinvent the wheel, and we wanted to be sure to recognize all the work that's already gone ahead. So this is just to reassure you that we are aware of and incorporating all of these good ideas that have already been generated into this work, so that we're building again on what's already been done rather than starting from scratch. Now, next slide. Thank you. So now we get into the demographic analysis, and what you'll see here is actually a shortened version. We have a lot of demographic data, but we thought this information really captures more about who lives in the unincorporated areas. Next slide, please. Thank you. You see that we have the data broken out for each of the sub areas in the unincorporated area so that you can do your own visual comparison. The blue bar is from 2012 and the orange bar is 2022. So we looked at a 10-year span here to look at how much population growth there's been. All of the sub areas except for Hayward Acres did grow a little bit. Castro Valley grew the most, but also Cherryland and Fairview did gain population. So some of that is new development, some of it is additional population moving into existing households. Next slide, please. This is what happened with incomes, and here we compare the incomes for Alameda County is the furthest bar on the left there. And then you see Castro Valley, Ashland, Cherryland. I'm sorry, the type is a little small here. So I'm hoping you can see this. But what's interesting is that all areas did have an increase in the median income. And remember, median is the midpoint. Half of the incomes are above and half of the incomes are below. So it's not skewed by average, by a very high or very low income. So this is just what the midpoint is. And you can see that, for example, Ashland and Cherryland in particular have relatively low median incomes. San Lorenzo and Fairview have higher median incomes relative to other places, again, in the Eden area. So that just gives you a sense. Castro Valley has higher incomes, as I'm sure you're probably aware. But we still think that there's plenty of buying power in the Eden area as well. So next slide, please. This is looking at race and ethnicity, and it's a very busy bar graph here. But what's interesting is that the Asian population has grown significantly in Ashland, Castro Valley, and San Lorenzo in the 10-year period we're looking at, whereas there's been a big increase in the Latino population in Cherryland and Hayward Acres. So there's some demographic shifts here that are going on that are not unlike what's going on in Alameda County. And again, Alameda County is the bar the furthest to the left. And that gray color represents Asian. So you can see there's been a huge increase in Asian population in San Lorenzo, for example. So, and again, you probably see this on the street on a day-to-day basis, knowing the people you live around and with. Next slide, please. And just to give a sense of who owns and who rents, and sometimes we think about owners as being more stable than renters, but that's not always the case, and particularly when it's become so expensive to own a house. In California, anywhere in California, pretty much anywhere in the US today, it's expensive. But the blue bar shows the renters, and the blue parts of the bar show renters, and the orange parts of the bar show homeowners. And so you can see that, for example, San Lorenzo has a very significant share of home ownership, as does Fairview. And then some of the areas that have the most significant numbers of renters are Ashland and Cherryland. So again, that's probably not unexpected. So next slide, please. So what we're finding in the unincorporated areas, that areas are become more racially and ethnically diverse. They vary by income, race, and education levels. We did look at occupation, levels of educational attainment. These things are all correlate to things like income. And that there is a varied distribution of homeowners versus renters. One of the things we're trying to explore here is the who would be supporting businesses and what kinds of incomes they have. So that's part of the story here and why we start with demographics. So next slide, please. So now looking at the commercial corridor analysis, and this sort of tells us what kinds of businesses are already here, what's the state of our real estate area. So as I said earlier, we focused on these key corridors, the Hesperian, Lowelling, East 14th, Mission Boulevard, and then for Castro Valley on Castro Valley Boulevard. And again, these are the places where you have the primary concentrations of commerce. Of course, San Lorenzo has its industrial district down by the bay, but we did not focus on that for San Lorenzo. We were primarily focused on Hesperian. So you'll, as you'll see in a minute, all our statistics are broken out by these corridors. So next slide, please. Thank you. So just in terms of looking at the inventory of retail space, what you can see from this chart is that Castro Valley has about 1 million square feet of retail inventory, as we call it. And then going down, East 14th Street has the most. And Lueling Boulevard has the least, which again, Lueling does not have very much commercial activity at all. And that did turn up to have ramifications for our study. The second column to the right shows the change in the retail inventory. Again, this goes back much further. It starts in 2006 and ends in 2024. And the reason that we didn't take that same 10-year snapshot that we used for the demographic analysis is because we had to go back much further in order to be able to find, you know, kind of the trends in terms of change. And because we were using a different data source, we could have much more current data. So we thought it would be interesting to see. And again, East 14th Street and Castro Valley Boulevard have added the most. Rents are a reflection of market strength. And so you can see that the rents are similar for Castro Valley Boulevard and East 14th Street. And again, East 14th Street is closer to San Leandro. It's close to Bayfair Mall. It's got sort of part of more of that retail hub. And then as you move down to Hesperian and Lueling, where you have less activity, the rents are also lower. So it kind of reflects a softer or a different kind of market area, as we talk about in the retail biz. Next slide, please. So this slide, the bar chart on the left, shows two things, and it's a busy, very colorful slide. So I'm going to walk you through it. The bars show when, in which decade most of the space was built. So you can see that the highest bar, and this is for all of the unincorporated areas combined, will break out the kind of retail that is in each area in the next slide. But I think that this is a really important slide to consider in that it shows you that most of the space that's in the unincorporated area was built prior to the 1970s. So it's old, it's potentially not in such great condition. And then a lot of it is in that blue color, which is general retail. So it means it's storefronts. So you think about Mission Boulevard, you think less so about Hesperian, but also parts of Castro Valley Boulevard, they have storefronts. Mission, right on the street. And that reflects the days in which these were the main roads that people traveled. There were streetcars on them, and that's why you have the storefronts. And then you see that different kinds of shopping centers became more popular as you come through the decades. So in the 1980s, for example, we had very little of that shop space built and more of this orange or yellow color, which are strip shopping centers. So this really reflects, this chart really reflects the transition from the storefront shop space, in some cases individual buildings, into these shopping center type configurations where one owner will own multiple shop fronts with parking in front. So next slide. So this now breaks this down in terms of the kind of development that exists in each of the sub areas. With a more subdued color palette. So, and the strip center is shown in that purple, and that dark green is the general retail. So you can see again, East 14th Street, Mission Boulevard, both have significant concentrations of that shopfront space, some neighborhood centers, whereas Hesperian, reflecting the time in which San Lorenzo was developed, has more of the neighborhood shopping center kind of space. So again, with parking in front and then the shop set back off the street. Next slide, please. This shows the kinds of reinvestment that's been happening. It's not a significant amount, and most of it has been concentrated in Castro Valley, which again, probably would come as no big surprise to you all. But Cherryland and San Lorenzo have also captured some reinvestment over the years, and we're hoping to get more. That's the whole goal for this study. So next slide, please. And then the other thing that we looked at was what's the mix of businesses in these areas, and this is actually based on the county's business license data, so it's pretty accurate. And What I want to do is call your attention to Mission Boulevard, which is the bar farthest to the right. And what you see is it has the most brown and dark blue. Those represent automotive sales and automotive services. So that's sort of like the car, the auto row, if you will, of the unincorporated Alameda County, whereas East 14th Street and Hesperian have more restaurants and more traditional retail. So you have a more diverse mix that's also serving more of the local residents of the area. Next slide, please. So just to wrap up, for the most part, the retail and commercial space along all five corridors is older. It's concentrated in small buildings rather than in shopping centers. And new retail investment has tended to be clustered along Castro Valley Boulevard and East 14th Street. Next slide, please. So now getting into sort of the nuts and bolts of the strategy is where do we have the opportunity to grow and to expand and try to attract new investment. So next slide, please. So we went through a very detailed process with the county staff, and this is where we also worked with Elizabeth and Tyler to review what our findings were. We met with you all twice, so thank you. Yeah, so I'm hoping we're accurately reflecting both of our conversations. But what we did was we started by looking at all the parcels on each corridor, each individual parcel of land owned by private owners. We looked at where they're located, how big they were, how they were shaped or configured. Do they have frontage on the main corridor? Do they have vacant space? How much rent are they charging? Is there some potential for future investment there, like a big parking lot that's not very well used? And then which sites are close to where other investment is happening? And interestingly enough, for those of you who have not seen any private investment in your corridor, public investment makes a difference too. So what we want to do is really build on where the county is doing streetscape improvement, where they're making pedestrian improvements, and then try to look to layer the public and private reinvestment together. So that's why we look at proximity to these other recent planned public and private investments. Then what we did was we grouped these opportunity sites into nodes. So again, we want to think about how to focus investment. If we spread it out, it's not going to feel like very much, but if we concentrate it, then we're going to have a better chance of creating a place with a little bit more sizzle. So next slide, please. So now we'll go through each of the corridors. You see that we have two, what we're calling nodes here, and you see the parcel lines are on here in the nodes, and the colors mean the following. So the green, the things that look like nice Kelly green, those are what we're calling opportunity sites. And these tended to be very underutilized places with junkyards, vacant sites, businesses that didn't look particularly well kept up, and they are close to other places where investment is being made. The blue sites are publicly owned space. So the light blue rectangle that's next to the purple rectangle is where the new park is being built. I understand this perhaps is the place that has not yet received a name.
No, it's not.
Not it? Okay.
That one already exists.
Yeah. So, and the purple site is the new housing project that's been built out there. So that's node one. And node two is across the street from the Hernandez produce market, which also has a vacant lot right to the south of it. So we're hoping to build on the synergy with the market itself. So we see that as an important potential anchor for the East 14th corridor. So these are the opportunity sites. And if you have any questions or comments, this is a good time to jump in.
Great.
You just have the mic turned on. Okay, so Warren Cushman here. You mentioned node one. This would be the node where the park, the existing park and the housing project is currently existing. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So are you going to be working with as you build that site out and you look for businesses and opportunities in that site, are you going to be working with HARD and with RCD to work with some of those folks to kind of help that along a little bit? Are you going to be working with community partners?
Well, yes. I think that's a great question. I'm writing down your comment, so I'm sure that I can capture it. We will not be developing any of this property. This is all privately owned property, all of the green area. But what we're hoping to do is make recommendations to the county on how to get those property owners on board with doing some redevelopment. And it's possible that RCD in particular could be interested in helping to facilitate that process. So it's a great question. Any other comments about this, about these two nodes?
Yeah, just really quickly. So I don't think when we see, the presentation, it starts with what's that coffee shop? Sorry. Yeah, Phil's Coffee. Yeah, so those sorts of chains, I don't envision, right?
You do not.
No, I don't envision, because we have, small businesses that are like Sushi Land and Angry Fish and Yo-Yo's Treats. So these are like small mom and pop businesses, and they do really, really well on these corridors. So that's just my sort of feedback of like maybe a strategy.
That's a great point. Yeah.
They're very community oriented businesses are the ones that thrive.
Yeah, that's really great. Thank you. That's one of the reasons why we picked Hernandez Market as an anchor, because we think it's really important to communicate that. And one of the ideas that we've been kind of kicking around is putting sort of a food truck pad in that adjacent, just exactly because you have people coming out of the incubator kitchen. Is there a way to synergize some startup on East 14th that speaks very much to the local community's resources? So yeah, but thank you for making that point. It's a great one. Yeah. Anything else? If not, we'll go to the next.
Yeah, I guess as we're going through the nodes,
yes,
are you generally just circling and saying something should happen here, or does your recommendation come with specific examples?
Yes, it will come with some specific examples and some specific recommendations. In other words, this is not the finished product. Sure. This is a starting point.
Got
also
it.
A good question. Let me just finish. Sorry. Later in the presentation, we'll show you what that content will look like.
Okay, that's helpful. Yeah. And I'll wait till the end, but I'm curious, will you base your recommendations only on what's happening locally, for example, within the unincorporated area, or will you look at comparable examples?
We're going to look for comparable examples from other places. So if you have places you'd like to suggest that we look at as case studies, that would be really helpful. So yeah, thank you.
I think I had brought this up before, but when you approach somebody with a potential idea of what this could look like, are you giving them mock-ups? I know, I think we had said if they see something, it's more powerful than just saying this could be better. If they see a good example of something else that's actually has improved, might inspire them.
Yeah. Yeah. That is something that we'll also be suggesting, is working with individual property owners. And we've done that in other places where we've actually gone through, shown a mock-up, given them a financial analysis so they could see what the business plan would look like for an improvement. If you invest this much, you're likely to be able to increase your rent. Therefore, you can cover the cost of the improvement and make more money. So yeah, so that could be a recommendation. Yeah, but we will incorporate that. Yeah, also great.
What about this idea, like their first commenter for public comment, you know, talked about our recommendation to deny a liquor store license. I mean, it was just out of node number two. Is there an intentionality that we should have as a board kind of going forward with, you know, looking, you know, at, you know, through a lens of your work here when we have to give a recommendation on tobacco licenses and liquor stores and, you know, those sort of CUPs?
Yeah.
I mean, does that influence perhaps a potential investor or a business owner looking to redevelop?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, there's a lot of research that's been done on that subject matter about how to handle liquor stores, particularly in disinvested areas. And there have been multiple attempts actually in Alameda County to repurpose liquor stores or to make them more diverse so that they have healthy food offerings as well. Those have been really hard efforts to sustain. So, but I think it's a great point, and I think it is something we should probably take a look at. Yeah, great. Okay, nothing yet. Okay, great. Okay, next slide, please. My partner in crime here, the slide changer. Thank you. Okay, so here we have Hesperian Boulevard, and we had quite a discussion about what to do at the north end and at the south end of the site, and ended up deciding to go with the north end of the site, partly because the Bohannons own a lot of property up there and have had some interest in the past in developing it. And having a willing property owner who is a developer is actually a good thing. And the county is investing in the, I believe it's a fire station, right? That's back there, right? Okay, good. It's been a little while since we've talked about this particular slide. So there is some opportunity and an ability to sort of think about how that intersection of Paseo Grande and Hesperian looks. And this is a case where we think some public-private partnership could be very helpful here. So that's why we chose to, and also the library is here, there's new housing that's been built here, there's like a lot to build on here in this area. So this is why we chose this node. You see those two red rectangles at the bottom of the area. We know that these are places where there's interest in seeing some long-term reinvestment. But we thought, given the use pattern, the size of the parcels, the ownership patterns down there, it's less likely that we could catalyze anything in the short to midterm. So we thought we would focus on the area where we had the best potential to perhaps get something going. Yes.
Okay, now I do have a question.
Yes, yes, ma'am.
I'm just confused because these parcels, all of these parcels, every empty parcel in San Lorenzo, as far as I can remember, has been rezoned for multi-use housing from the housing element. So can you reconsider these as commercial, and what would you have to get them rezoned again or something? How's that going to work?
Yeah, that's a great question. We did have the housing element sites on these early maps. Remember, we talked about that in January, and we ended up taking those sites off. So these opportunity sites exclude the housing element sites. But we will be looking at the zoning. That's a great point, because zoning itself can be catalytic if you have the wrong zoning in place. And so we will look to see whether or not we think housing is actually the best use in this area, where we think mixed use, so you might have retail on the ground floor, housing above, or you might have a row of shops that are in front of development that's occurring in back, like in Union City, on Union City Boulevard, there is a project like that that has a single bar of retail space in the front of the site, and then behind it is a lot of townhouse development. So we want to be sure that the zoning is right here, and actually under the housing element opportunity site or housing element sites, you could still do some of that mixed use development. So I don't, on the surface, they don't necessarily contradict each other.
Okay, because my mind just kind of erased any commercial from that area. And just another complication that I know you're aware of from reading toward the end of your whole presentation, but while you're doing this and housing's doing whatever it's doing, there's also another group that's working on a new San Lorenzo specific area.
Yeah, right, yeah, the specific plan. We have been coordinating with the planning department. And so we will continue to do that as we move through the implementation. In other words, we do not want to be working at cross purposes, nor do we want to be canceling each other out. So, yeah, we will be paying attention.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, thank you. Any other comments about Hesperian? No? Okay, Lou Elling. Next slide, please. Sorry. I'm sorry. I have them out of order. Mission Boulevard. Mission Boulevard also has some interesting opportunity sites here. Again, we looked at a north and a south set of nodes here and decided to focus around the north where there is the opportunity where the county owns a bunch of land. And I believe there is another park under construction here, right? Yep. Okay, good. So there's already investment. So we think there's an opportunity again to look at getting more investment here and potentially more of this mixed use. So some retail, some housing. These all make sense to you all? Good? Okay. Next slide, please. And we save Lou Elling for the last because Lou Elling really, we looked long and hard and we talked about this at great length and we couldn't really find any good opportunity sites here. The parcels are very small. They're not very good quality development sites. Yes, sir.
Can you go back one slide?
Yes.
Just for questions.
Yes.
I'm trying to piece together the green, the southernmost green.
The southernmost green.
Just north of Medford Avenue.
Yeah.
Go down to coffee, Saba coffee, or whatever.
Thank you. I guess so it means that your opportunity zones may be, or nodes may be existing
yep.
businesses. Mm-hmm. And then have you consulted them in terms of having them listed, having the property where they are today listed here as
right. So again, these are privately owned right. properties. And what we're doing is recommending what the actions the county could take to make it easier for private property owners to consider redeveloping their own property.
Got it.
Okay. So that's why zoning, for example, which controls the land use on the site, is very important. So I think we did want to take into account these locally owned businesses. And we have seen cases of redevelopment where businesses are reincorporated back into the new development or they are relocated. The city of Berkeley has done this multiple times with interesting businesses, including a vacuum cleaner repair and sewing machine repair shop that was relocated out of a development site rather than lost. So I think these are, again, examples of very small, very local businesses that have been retained even when redevelopment is occurring.
Okay, that makes sense. And then just a quick follow-up. Across the street from that green is an existing shopping center.
Right.
Why isn't that highlighted from your perspective?
Because it's a grocery store. Grocery stores are an important asset in a neighborhood and in a community. We don't want to, you know, recommend that that be redeveloped out of existence. Instead, we want that to continue, that activity to continue to anchor the area.
So I challenge that.
Okay.
In the sense that that's a shopping center.
Yeah.
That has a grocery store.
Mm-hmm.
And I fully agree with what you said about the grocery store as an anchor tenant.
Yeah.
But there's other premises, there's other businesses. Yeah. And I would strongly recommend to have a second look.
Okay.
And not assume, because a lot of that is vacant. I won't say a lot, but there are existing. Yeah, they're vacant businesses in that shopping center.
Okay. It's a great point. Great. We'll take a look. Anything else come to mind?
Actually, one more. Yes.
Okay, great.
This is where I live. Yeah. So
No, I'd rather have somebody give me feedback than not be interested.
So I walk these streets often. Towards the bottom of where it says node one, so it's kind of the intersection of Maddox and Foothill Boulevard.
Yep.
There's an open lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that it seasonally becomes a lot where they sell Christmas trees.
Mm-hmm.
But outside of that, I've not seen any activity.
Okay. Yeah, Foothill wasn't, we were really focused on Mission, not on Foothill. So that might be a reason why it's not shown here, but we'll take another look at it.
Yeah, what I would advocate for taking a look at it is it's a high traffic area, definitely in terms of vehicular traffic, but also cyclists, and then to a lesser extent, pedestrians.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, somebody else commented about a gateway into our neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
That is a main thoroughfare into Cherryland.
Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, back to Llewellyn, where we see a couple of these long-term opportunities. But again, we think that these sites are quite challenging. The triangle site to the to the left, to the west, there is a kind of a series of auto body related activities, and it looks pretty underutilized. And then the odd-shaped parcel to the right, I think, is a used car dealership. So they're kind of challenging uses. They're not in particularly highly visible locations. They're not close to other things that are going to catalyze. So we will still have recommendations for things to do for Llewellyn Boulevard. We're not leaving it out of the study altogether, but we just don't see any opportunities for near to midterm private investment in this area.
Yeah, just to comment on the one farthest to the right. Llewellyn and Mission.
Mm-hmm.
The MAC heard a CUP kind of like on the same line, you know, along the same lines as a liquor store for a car wash facility, right? Mm-hmm. And we just, you know, with the idling cars, the exhaust, the noise of, you know, the drying being right next to adjacent to the, you know, single family homes, you know, we voted that one down.
Yeah.
But, you know, within that shopping center, which is, you know, it's pretty close to dilapidated, there's this really, really prized Portuguese bakery.
Yes,
that,
right. Yeah. Right.
That if you drive by it, just, it smells great. and they have really great stuff. So I'm wondering, will that, you know, say if someone came forward and wanted to develop that, would that bakery be like able to be relocated, or would funds be available if they weren't included in that node? I'm just wondering, like, the pluses and minuses. Are these nodes like official, so to speak, in a way that they have access to more resources or?
Well, they could. Yes. I think, okay. Yeah. The answer is yes, maybe. I hope. Right. Right. I think that's fair. I hear Susan chuckling behind me. But I thought you were maybe going in a different direction, which would be that that Portuguese bakery be sort of lifted up, get a facelift, become seen as more of an anchor for the neighborhood. And I think that's actually a better short-term strategy than thinking about how we might relocate it.
Yeah, so absolutely.
I hadn't thought about that. Yeah. I thought when I was reviewing these again this evening before I came out here, I was looking at that and thinking, oh.
Yeah.
And a few weeks ago, I was in a small commercial area on the east side of San Jose that also has a very famous bakery, and people are coming from outside the area to shop there.
Yeah, I was at like a wedding party in all the way in San Pablo. Uh-huh. And I said, wow, these are great. Where'd you get these? Oh, this place on the Welling. It's like, really? All the way down? You went all the way down there?
Interesting.
So
yeah.
It's really, yeah, I like that idea. Yeah. I was just kind of speaking in the context of our sort of situation with that parcel is like we've gotten redevelopment sort of applications that they're not really meeting the expectation of our specific plan and whatnot.
That's a great point too. So yeah, so thank you. We'll think a little bit more about both of those.
Okay.
So yeah.
So I have thoughts on that strip.
Yes.
By the way, Las Montañas is the supermarket from in the Cherrylands zone that I wanted to give a shout out to, just to name it.
Okay, great.
And put in a plug for them. So on Llewelling, it was the only area that had negative economic growth from your earlier chart. And I would like to advocate on behalf of the Strip using some of the language and principles you've been sharing here. So the first one being, are you aware of the county's investment in that strip?
Yes, that's what we're going to try to build off of. Yeah.
But the investment is going across not just the front and the back, but the entire strip.
Uh-huh.
So okay. Doesn't that open up further opportunities than just the two red dots you have today?
We'll have to relook at that. I didn't think that it was significant enough to open up more of these opportunity sites, but it's those kinds of public investments that we really want to focus on for this area. So that
absolutely.
Yeah, something.
Yeah, like just as an example, they're going to have a lot more pleasant sidewalk available.
Exactly.
So that should be something.
Exactly. And I think, you know, one of the things that's interesting about these public investments is that there's a lot of research that shows that if you invest in improving streetscapes, just trees and the sidewalks, as you're pointing out, people will pay more to live in the houses behind. Not that we want to increase property values, but it the point is that it changes people's perceptions of an area, and that could help to tip the viability of these sites.
Completely agree. And thanks for mentioning not wanting to raise housing prices.
Yeah, right.
Because I think that's
it's a double-edged sword.
Right.
But on the other hand, we want people to have quality places to live.
Yes.
Right.
And then related to this, and I think it's on the southern end of the triangle that mm-hmm. you're showing.
Yep.
Is that Meek Park? Is that the back of the park? It's a little hard for me to tell.
It's hard for me to tell too. Okay. It's across the street. It's across from the park, I believe. The creek is there. And,
yes.
Yeah, right.
So have you taken that into consideration?
Yeah, we did. We looked at that and we tried to figure out if that was sufficient to sort of be transformative.
Yeah. And the only thing I would suggest is there is a walkway. I think it's just the one from Llewelling to Meek, but that could be something that mm-hmm. can be built around and draw more people.
Yep.
And just to sort of back Ray up just a little bit, right across the street from the going south is the East Bay Mud Utility District. It's like a gas station, and it just really doesn't fit in.
Yeah.
And we've been advocating that they relocate that, but it's just something to.
Yeah.
And then the East Bay Greenway, obviously.
Yeah.
kind of like an Ohlone Greenway using the railroad right of way.
Yeah. Okay, I just want to remind us that we have the Brown training that'll take up to about an hour and a half. So if, maybe if you can finish up, and then if we have any leftover questions, we can
Take care of them. Okay, well, this is
Thank you.
I mean, I just have a few more slides. Yeah, but this is very helpful feedback.
And also, not just the East Bay Greenway, but there's a San Lorenzo Creek planned greenway.
Uh-huh. Okay. Greenways are a great resource to build on.
Diane, thanks for moving us on. But this is also like really important and good as well. So
yeah, no,
thank you.
I'm writing as fast as I can. This is great. Okay, good. Okay, just to give you some sense of what the strategy that is going to look like. Next slide, please. So we're going to have commercial corridor strategies for each of the five corridors. So that's sort of like what's happening on the length of the corridor. Is there something we want to do for the entire length of Llewellyn, the entire length of Hesperian, so that no area is not getting some attention? And then what do we want to do specifically to try to catalyze development in these nodes? So that's kind of the idea. And then there will be one big strategy that's going to focus on the entire unincorporated area. This is a funding strategy, and it's looking at bringing back infrastructure tax increment financing, which is an old mechanism that we used a lot in California before 2012. And the county has a lot of ability to bring that back and to generate money that could be spent in these areas. So that's something that's kind of our evil plan, to recommend that to the Board of Supervisors so that we can actually put money behind these ideas, right? So that's that. So next slide, please. I don't want to go in too much detail here, but I do want to, again, point out that for each of the sub-areas, so for San Lorenzo, Cherryland, Ashland, et cetera, we will give some of the existing conditions that I went over in the beginning of the presentation. We will be listing out what recent investments have been made so you can see what we're building on. And then the economic development strategies will incorporate into them all existing strategies that are relevant from existing planning documents and then new ideas. The other thing in response to your question, sir, we will be using case studies a lot, and we will not be using just case studies from these areas, but we'll be looking elsewhere in Alameda County. But also we found some interesting case studies like in Santa Rosa. They have an interesting food truck kind of activity. So if you have places or some place that you've seen that you think, oh, would that be something we could do here? Feel free to shout it out now, or you can get in touch with Jamie.
Fremont.
Fremont. What in Fremont?
A lot more housing that they've built in the last several years, yeah. And mixed density housing and retail.
Great. Okay. I know because I drove through Niles recently and I thought, oh, this looks kind of cute. Yeah, you're looking at downtown Fremont. Okay. Okay. Great. Okay, good. Okay, next slide, please. This is just my last slide. Next slide, please. Again, we are coordinating with the specific plan, so we even have it in our slide here. Case studies, as I said, and then we'll be developing our implementation strategies. We didn't want to go forward until we had really had a chance to present this to you and be sure you all were comfortable with this. So we're a little bit behind in our schedule, but we're hoping to have the strategy, a draft strategy for you in July. We might at this point push to August, but we'll see. But you'll by the end of the summer, I'll be popping back around to say hi and show you what we've got. So I think that's it.
I had a question.
Kate.
Have any of the sites been considered for like larger spaces? I don't know if you're familiar with like the Barlow in Sebastopol or I guess maybe some of the food halls like in Castro Valley or in San Jose were similar models. I don't know if you have this space on any of these parcels that could accommodate that type of like multi, you know, food retail, but some of it's art also. Those types of areas. That's just a question slash suggestion.
We haven't gotten that far, but those are both great suggestions. Other people have talked to us about that project in Sebastopol. So, yeah. And there's some interesting models from around the country of things that have been done with Airstream trailers and, you know, very light touch that then become a focal point. So that's why some of these vacant or even an underutilized parking lot could accommodate some of that kind of activity.
Right. That's what, and I'm not familiar if this has been discussed, but that's kind of what they did with the food truck on the corner of Llewellyn and Paseo or Via Granada right there. It was just a lot. And I don't know what the details are, but now there's a food truck that kind of owns the space and has put picnic tables and.
Okay. Where is it? Which at Llewellyn and?
It's Via Granada and Llewellyn.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. They have portable restrooms and they put up picnic tables and they move the food truck out, you know, when they're not open. And then when they're open, the food truck is there and they have bocce ball and that sort of thing.
And bocce ball. Okay.
I'm thinking about your key informants. Who are they or who do they represent?
They mostly represent places that these case studies. So we were going to talk to some developers. We haven't gotten there yet. And again, if you have ideas or suggestions of people to whom you'd like us to speak.
Housing sounds great. And different types of housing developers, I think.
Yeah, right.
High density, low density, mixed density.
It's like City Ventures, who did this project that I was referring to in Union City.
Commercial and retail makes a lot of sense. Maybe other park districts.
Okay.
Or park.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Departments.
Great.
I know there's like a lot of revitalization going around the Ballers Stadium in West Oakland. They're doing like a Prescott night market. I'm not sure who coordinates that, whether it's the city or.
Yeah, he's an amazing developer. Okay. He's very focused on that particular neighborhood, but I think it's a great idea. Yeah, it's probably worth talking to him. I never turn down an opportunity to talk to Joe Ernst. Have you been over there to that market?
I have not yet. I've gone to a few games, but not yet.
Yeah, I want to get over there too. Yeah, I haven't been over there.
What's his name?
Joe Ernst is the developer who's worked with the guy who put together the market. He's actually a life science and biotech developer, and he works in Alameda and in Emeryville. And then now he's focused on West Oakland.
Mm.
So interesting guy. Yeah.
Any other follow-up, last-minute questions? Yeah, Warren.
Sir.
So I strongly encourage the department to make sure that there are a lot of community partners and not only the planning department and other internal county folks, but also nonprofits, HARD, other community partners, RCD, for example, schools. I mean, there are the community is more than just developers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fine to talk to developers, but what the whole community works when you have a lot of different people at the table.
Yeah.
The other thing I would say is I have every confidence in our economic committee here on this board.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that, you know, it'll be helpful for us to hear reports from them as well.
Okay.
So, you know, I trust their judgment. I just want them to know that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I just so you know, we are working with the Eden Church and several of the nonprofits that are there in another project, and it does intersect with this one. So I really fully appreciate your point because we know those people and they're fantastic. Yeah, great. And RCD is involved, so great. Okay, well,
anyone else? I would expect that you'll be back in after some incremental stages to give us updates too. Okay, let's see if we have any public speakers. Can we limit their time to like a minute and a half?
Sure. Randy Wage.
Well, good and then, well, I'm breaking this thing. A good and insightful presentation. For me, I'm always frustrated because Bohannon owns most of our property in San Lorenzo. And at one time we had food trucks in the old parking lot. And I would like to see that again. So I'm kind of throwing that in the universe. We tried to bring it over to the library, but it didn't work. The best spot really is once a week on the old Bohannon lot. I'd also like to see a, what's that called? Like a fresh market like Bayfair has, where they have all the farmers market. We had approached the Bayfair people, but they thought that our library parking lot was too small. So the Bohannon lot would be great for that. I do like what you say about Union City with all the retail down below and the housing on top. I would like to see that in San Lorenzo too. Our rezoning is frustrating, but I would like to see mixed use and maybe it'll happen. It always seems when these developers come in, they just don't want any retail. They just want housing. And also the Bohannon lot. It doesn't matter a meeting with Lisa or quarterly things with the Bohannons. People have always talked about where the old Mervyn's used to be. It could be a park, a temporary dog park, anything, anything. We just need those fences to come down. Thank you so much.
Cindy Torres.
Thank you for the presentation. Really quickly, I want to mention that in 2015, when the community came together and worked on the business, Ashland Chairland Business Specific Plan, we did have a design and idea for the EdMed property and to be mixed use retail and park and to extend the Meek Estate that goes, you know, across the San Lorenzo Creek. So that idea has been out there for quite a while. And so I would like to add that if you can uplift that in your report to do something with that. It's been there for since 2015. Also, when we talk about areas like where this Silva Bakery is, I would like to look at those things as maybe bringing some historic charm to our communities instead of regentrification and all of that, and to get more community input in what we would like to see. You know, I can't see something big and huge going in there with the charm of the community that's around it. It has to have something that fits in with it. And so I would like to also look at that, even though that's a private, privately owned. And it would help if something could be done with the empty U-Haul site across the way, you know? Sushi Land purchased the buildings around there, and so they're gonna develop that. So, you know, and the gas station. I mean, that is really the entrance to that way, and that just really does need to be improved. So something, you know, those are the things that would really make a difference in that area. Thank you.
No more speakers.
Okay, so we'll close public comment. And next thing in our agenda is, it's a Brown Act training and code of conduct presentation for us council members. That's not to say everyone else can't listen and pay attention and hold our toes to the fire, maybe.
Okay, how's that? Better. All right, good evening, everyone. My name is Melanie O'Brien. I'm a deputy county counsel with the county council's office, and I have been asked to give this Brown Act training to your council this evening. My training is not going to be limited to the Brown Act. We're going to talk about some code of conduct and a sprinkle of the Levine Act as well. I'd like to remind the public they're welcome to attend this event. It's intended to be a training for your council, but this is on your agenda and the public is welcome to attend and we'll be taking public comment. I have, believe it or not, reduced the number of slides. So I'm hoping to get through this as quickly as I can. It's up to you how you want to handle this. If you have questions, which I imagine you will during my training, you can ask those questions as long as I get to say to you that's coming up in the next slide. And then any discussion we could have at the end if you had any thoughts or questions beyond that. All right. So the guiding principle, next slide, the guiding principle of the Brown Act, the public's business must be conducted in public with ample opportunity for public participation. It's the ethos of the Brown Act that the public gets to attend your meetings, participate in your meetings, and be given notice of your meetings. Who is subject to the Brown Act? Any board, commission, committee, or other body created by a charter, ordinance, resolution, or other formal action of the Board of Supervisors. And your council was created by action of the Board of Supervisors, making it subject to the Brown Act. So the Brown Act is governed by the open meeting rule. The rule is that meetings are open to the public. Exceptions to the rule are narrowly construed. All meetings of the legislative body of a local agency shall be open and public, and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting of the legislative body of a local agency. So what is a meeting? Not as simple as it seems, right? A meeting occurs whenever a majority of the members of your council or of a subcommittee of the council come together at the same time or place. So I believe there are seven of you on the council, so a meeting would be four or more of you. Meetings can be formal or informal. They can involve only discussion or action or both, in person or through technology. So texting, Facebook Messenger, all of those informal ways we communicate. I mean, I guess technically winking could be a meeting if there were enough of you, right? Meetings can include retreats, site visits, or field trips, social gatherings or networkings before or after a notice meeting. That includes happy hours. That includes hanging out in the parking lot.
I have a question.
Sure.
That is pertaining to agendized items, correct?
It's a, when you get together and you just, and I'll get into the exceptions, when there's a majority of you and get together, discuss whatever the subject of your body is.
So if we, if I was on a text thread with, you know, four other people and we were scheduling bowling, that would not be running afoul of the Brown Act.
You can go bowling.
Okay.
But I would really caution you in doing so if it was a majority of your council going bowling together. But you can technically, yes, go bowling. Social gatherings are permitted.
And what is a legislative body? Do we make legislation?
You don't necessarily make it in and of itself, but you advise the Board of Supervisors who does, and you're a piece of that functioning. You are a legislative body for the purposes of the Brown Act.
Okay.
I have a question. Are we supposed to ask someone, like if... you say, it's my birthday, everybody come bowling with me. Am I supposed to ask somebody before I can invite them or what?
There's nobody I know that you could go ask that question to. Okay. If you wanted to ask staff, if that was permissible, but I'm going to get to the slide that says that social gatherings are A-okay. But I would say, you know, if you're going to go bowling, I really like this wholesome activity that you're all engaging in.
Now we have to, I think.
Right. I would say make it abundantly clear, hey, we're not discussing any business of our council. That is not to come up at all today. If that happens, we must cease the conversation and make that clear. This is a social gathering. It's for your birthday.
So we have to ask Tona or Ashley or...
No, you have to ask it.
But we maybe should.
This is me telling you.
Okay. You're theoretically.
You're being trained right now.
Okay.
You can now know that social gatherings are okay. But just remember, when they happen matters. It's going to look awfully weird if you go out right after this, right? And you go to a happy hour. I guess it's not happy hour, but go to a late night hangout. Or if you hang out in the parking lot before this, that really gives the air that you are discussing business that the people should be have access to. So common sense. All right. What are the types? Oh, I'm sorry. Let's go back. When I say that, I'm saying that to myself. We talked about pre-meetings and post-meetings held without notice to the public being illegal. So those are the parking lot meetings. Those are the after-hours meetings after this meeting tonight, if you were to do that. And then also, this is a concept called serial meetings. Now, these are the meetings that you have without knowing that you're having an illegal meeting. So types of serial meetings. Next slide. We've got cool graphics coming up. All right, we have the chain meeting where member A talks to member B, who talks to member C, and that creates an inadvertent meeting where you have to go D there for the four of you to have the majority. Or a hub and spoke meeting where A talks to B, A talks to C, A talks to D. And there you're creating an illegal meeting because you are communicating the thoughts of one person on the council, and you're communicating it to multiple people, creating a majority. And that's why it's so difficult, because let's say you're bowling in this scenario and just one person says something to somebody else, right? And you think, okay, I'm just talking to one person about the council's business. We have an agenda item coming up. I'm going to mention it to them. And then that person goes and mentions it to someone else, unbeknownst to you, and you're not part of that conversation. If that happens enough time, you've had an illegal meeting. Okay, how do serial meetings occur? They can be in person, but typically through text, email, phones, or even through staff. If you were to tell staff to communicate something on your behalf to another member of your council. This is why technology is so rough. Like, you want to avoid forwarding messages, texting, because you don't have control over who that message is going to. And I'm talking not about your bowling party, but about sending something about, well, this is coming up on tonight's agenda, or I'm really interested in this item. You want to avoid sending those because you don't have control over where it's going to go next. You don't know if someone else is going to forward that email to another member of your council, and you'll have had an illegal meeting inadvertently. So what can you tell staff? Staff can answer questions or provide information to individual members so long as the views and positions expressed by the member are not communicated to other members. So you can't tell staff that this is how you intend to vote, or ask that they share an opinion or even potentially an article if you want to sway a vote right in your favor. You can't use staff, as this graphic shows, as a way of communicating information where you're trying to ultimately achieve the purpose of communicating with each other, which needs to be done open and in public. Sure.
Excuse me, I'm just wondering, just because I'm familiar with Davis Sterling, and I don't know if this is the same or not, but they said that email messages were no longer considered meetings if there was no decision-making process and it was just like informational or thinking. But is it different for the Brown Act? Would that be a violation of the Brown Act then?
Yes, that okay. would be an illegal meeting. Tyler, were you going to say something? Okay. So what isn't a meeting? I finally got to the slide to answer the bowling question. Attendance of the majority at a regional, state, national conference, a local meeting open to the public, meaning you're going to a different meeting that is open to the public. If you wanted to, for instance, go to a planning commission meeting, the majority or more of you. Social, recreational, or ceremonial event not sponsored by or for the body. Birthday bowling, perfect example of that. But no collective discussion of the council business can occur at these events, as I've mentioned, ad nauseum.
So I think sometimes the agenda is set. I think every time the agenda is set for this meeting. So even those emails saying, here's the tentative agenda, and then 2 weeks later, a week later, here's the final agenda. Is that a meeting?
Those are emailed by staff, correct?
Yes.
That's fine, because staff is telling that to you and they're giving you the information. They're doing the same thing with the public. Remember, that's the essence of the Brown Act. Everybody's getting this at the same time. You were to take that agenda and said, if you forward it to Tyler, potentially creating an illegal serial meeting, and say, I'm really excited about this item. Well, okay, who's he going to forward it to? Or if you were to forward it to everybody and say, looking forward to seeing you all tonight, really excited about item number two, that creates an illegal meeting. So staff can inform all of you of the date or provide the agenda, or even to say a meeting's been canceled. That's totally fine.
And if we respond to staff and say, oh, that's great, can we add this to the agenda, or that to, is that permissible?
Well, if all of you are on there, you should really be doing that in public. You should really be saying in that public meeting, you should be saying, I'd like to add this to the next agenda.
But it's an email.
Right, but you're not noticing it. That email is not following the Brown Act because it's not noticed. The public doesn't have access to the idea that you want that, and you're conveying that to everybody on the council.
So staff can tell us what the agenda is. We can't suggest the agenda back in that same email thread.
Right, exactly. Now, I don't know how you, I don't know the inner practices or your bylaws of your council, if it provides that the chair is allowed to ask staff to take something off or requires approval of the chair. It could just be just the chair and staff, if that's something.
What we usually do is have a follow-up meeting after this meeting, and staff will tell Warren and I, it's the president and vice president, will tell us proposed items or potential items for the next agenda. And then she'll ask us if we have anything to add to the agenda or anything we'd like to see on the agenda.
And that's the two of you?
And the staff? The chair and the vice chair.
I mean, that's likely okay as long as you have the potential of creating an expanded inadvertent serial meeting, but it sounds like that's the practice of how you organize your agenda. But it doesn't sound like it's the practice of how you organize your agenda of having one council member responding to staff, to the whole group, and say, oh, I want this to be here. And then you have communicated your opinion to the legislative body, and that would be an illegal meeting.
But one member could email either Warren or I, right, and say, would you guys consider having this on the next agenda? And then we can talk to staff when we build the agenda and add it, or if we want to.
Yes, because it's less than a majority. Right. Again, be careful with emails. It's better to do that in person. It's okay. Better to do that at the meeting and say, you know, if you have a section on your agenda, I haven't taken close enough look at it, maybe comments or you know, member suggestions or whatever the open categories, I'd like to see that on the next agenda. Then you're totally avoiding any sort of confusion or forwarding issues.
Okay, what about, all this seems future focused. What about the past? What if we want to say how stupid something was 6 months ago? Is that okay? Or something that doesn't, it's never going to come up again on the agenda?
Well, I've worked for the county for 2 years now, and I've seen things come back on the agenda that people never thought were going to come back on agendas. I'd say never say never and err on the side of caution. That's still part of the jurisdiction of your council, and avoid doing that.
Okay.
The public still has a right to know what you think about things that you might never see on the agenda when they're under the purview of your body.
They can ask me. I'll tell them.
I'm going to move on to social media. The Brown Act applies to internet-based social media platforms. That's Twitter or X, Facebook, Instagram. We've left out TikTok here. That would certainly apply. So a meeting, good news, a meeting does not include a member engaging in a separate conversation or communication on a social media platform to answer questions, provide information to, or to solicit information from the public regarding a matter within the subject matter jurisdiction of the legislative body. That was a long sentence, but essentially it means you can do the work of your body by one of you answering questions that the public is posing, or post your agenda on your Facebook account saying we're having this meeting. Next slide, thank you. So it's of course complicated in the fact that social media has features that are unlike just saying a comment feature, right, where all of you could add on and say, great, see you then, and then you have an illegal meeting. We also have likes, smiley faces, all of those things. So social media communications that are made, posted, shared on social media platforms between members, including the use of digital icons that express reactions, can create an illegal meeting. Because if one of you posts, I'm going to vote this way at the meeting, and then three of you like it, well, there you've had an illegal meeting. I know that this is, the future, but we want to avoid commenting on people's social media posts, because then we could engage in a potential illegal meeting. I'm going to move on from what is a meeting to some basics, which you probably all know. But the requirements of your meetings is that they must be within Alameda County. They must occur at a time, place set by ordinance, resolution, bylaws, or other rule of the body. And we have now technology to allow you to potentially appear in meetings remotely, what we call teleconferencing. And teleconferencing is complicated. So we have the old teleconference rules pre-COVID, right? Where a meeting of the legislative body is with different locations and you're connected through electronic means, either through audio or video. And of course, the next bullet, it does allow you to provide other means of electronic connection if you wanted to have it on multiple platforms. But the traditional teleconference rules are different from what I'll be referring to later as just cause or emergency circumstances rules. So this is traditional teleconference, still exists, but this is all we had before the pandemic, which is that each teleconference location, if you wanted to appear remotely, had to be posted on the agenda. I guess I should say has to be posted on the agenda if you choose to go down this road. If you're going to teleconference at a teleconference location, you must post that agenda at that location, and that means within 72 hours you need to post it there. And then each location that you're teleconferencing at must have public access, meaning the public must be able to speak at that location. You must be able to provide them with technology at that location for them to participate. And a quorum must be within the county for using traditional teleconference rules. All votes must be taken by roll call. Are you all familiar with traditional teleconferencing in general, the posting the address on the agenda, putting it out 72 hours beforehand in that location? So something that people often, you know, wish to do is they want to use traditional teleconferencing and they want to do it at their home. And you have to be mindful of the fact that that address is going to be on the agenda. And then not only that, you need to welcome the public in, right? You need to provide a place for them to sit. And your home should be ADA accessible because you need it to make sure you're accommodating the public. You want to make sure that they have the ability to use whatever device you're connecting with, so your laptop or a phone, to attend the meeting. And for that reason, most people do not want to do this in their home. Typically, they select a public facility such as a library to hold their teleconference location. You can teleconference anywhere. You can teleconference from China if you want to. Just remember that a quorum of the members, the council, I'll use that interchangeably, need to be in the county.
Okay, thank you. So I'm, first of all, I want to ask you, Emily, right? Is that right, Emily?
Melanie,
okay. Melanie, question, does the county honor Rob Bonta's decision to support people with disabilities remoting from their homes?
Is the question whether or not there are accommodations for people with disabilities to attend meetings from their homes?
Yeah, Rob Bonta, I ruled very recently that it was within the realm of the Brown Act to allow people with disabilities to teleconference from their homes.
So I will get into the next type of teleconferencing, which is that just cause. And under just cause, you can attend remotely or teleconference remotely on grounds of disability, but there are limits to that.
Yeah. Are you aware of the Rob Bonta decision that just came down maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago?
I'm not aware.
Okay. You may want to take a look at it because it might change the perception of how things are looked at. The other question I have is, are you aware that right now there's at least one bill, a Brown Act bill in the legislature, that would allow members of advisory bodies to teleconference from their homes as well?
I was not aware of that either.
Oh, yeah, so these are, the pandemic rules are really changing the course of things, and it's a constantly changing two-step around this whole thing. So I think that's a good thing to think about, is that we may actually have different rules a year from now than we have now.
And I'll be right here potentially telling you about them if that's the case. The Brown Act is ever evolving, and it's also, it evolves because our technology changes and our lifestyles have changed. And I can get into AB 2449, which is the just cause or emergency circumstances, which we'll touch on this a little bit, but there are caps, meaning annual amount of times that you're able to use a disability, and I believe it's 2 times a year. So it doesn't just allow people in perpetuity, members in perpetuity, to use their disability to use teleconferencing. And I will take a look at the opinion you quoted. Go ahead.
Not that I care, but we don't have a planning commissioner that comes into meetings anymore. So is that a just cause teleconferencing for our planning commissioner?
That's teleconferencing, traditional.
So traditional.
There's an address posted.
Okay. Okay, so just cause, you wouldn't have to have the public process part.
Right. So the difference between traditional teleconferencing is that you can plan ahead. I know I'm going to China in 3 weeks, so I'm going to have this put on the agenda, right?
Yeah.
Just cause an emergency circumstance has to do with either, and this is a summary, but a medical situation that's come up. Therefore, for you or your child or your spouse, or an emergency, right? And you have to attend to it very quickly. So we don't make people go through rules where we have to re-notice the agendas with their address on them, because these circumstances are, time is of the essence, and there's really limited amount of time for you to do something like this. And I just want to say that you can also not go to a meeting. This is, people get a little confused. They're like, oh no, I have to do all this. You know, obviously there has to be a quorum of you to have a meeting, but you do not have to go through these steps. If there is an emergency, you can just not attend the meeting. All right. So new law effective January 1st, 2023, which does not require a state of emergency. The previous rules did do the pandemic. This is the overhauled legislation for just cause and emergency circumstances. To use just cause or emergency circumstances, at least a quorum must meet in person within the body's jurisdiction. So that means that there must be four of you here in person, and then the member who is using just cause or emergency circumstances can appear telephonically. So there cannot be three of you here if somebody is using just cause emergency circumstances. And when I say here, I mean physically here. Members can participate via teleconference a limited amount of times if either just cause or emergency circumstances exist. There is a notification request process to participate via teleconference. So they have to alert the chair, I need to participate via teleconference. If you use just cause with emergency circumstances, I'm sorry, if you use teleconference with just cause or emergency circumstances, you have to use video and audio. With traditional teleconferencing, it's just audio, but you need to have your video and audio on. So it's something to keep in mind if you are having an emergency, whether you can do that or not. You must announce if there is anyone 18 years or older with you and identify the person and their relationship to you. So getting into the nitty gritty of the difference between just cause and emergency circumstance. Just cause is defined as childcare or caregiving for a child, parent, grandparent, grandchild, sibling, spouse, or domestic partner that requires remote participation, or it can be a contagious illness that prevents the member from attending in person. You do not need to say your illness, just that you have a contagious illness, or a need related to a disability not otherwise accommodated, or travel while on official business of the legislative body or state or local agency. You can't use this more than 2 meetings in a calendar year, and you do not need to give as a body permission when using just cause for the member to appear by teleconference. But the reason for teleconferencing must be disclosed on the record by the member. Again, you do not have to say the contagious illness. You can just say, I have a contagious illness. You don't need to say the disability. You can just say, I have a disability that cannot be accommodated otherwise. And the request must be made at the earliest opportunity. So when you know you need to use this, you should tell the chair as soon as you can. So the next one, emergency circumstances, similar to just cause, defined as a physical or family medical emergency that prevents a person prevents a member from attending in person. There's no specific time limit on the number of times emergency circumstances can be used, but the annual cap generally limits use. The remote participation due to emergency circumstances must be specifically approved by the legislative body as an action item. So this is different than just cause. You have to approve that this is an emergency in your eyes as a body. A request can be added to the agenda and must be acted on at the beginning of the meeting. The member must provide a general description of the emergency, and the description does not need to exceed 20 words. And you don't need to reveal any personal information or private information. Okay, more on AB 2449. This touches on the emergency circumstances cap. No more than 3 consecutive months of teleconferencing and no more than 20% of the meetings per calendar year. Of course, they made this one a little bit different than the other one. That way we have to always look it up. The agendas for either of these do not need to be posted at the remote location, and the local agencies, that means you, need to be able to provide to the public a two-way audiovisual platform and a two-way telephonic service and live webcasting of the meeting if somebody appears this way. These are very technical rules, basically doing what you're doing now, and having them appear by Zoom would be fine with that. And the public must still be able to attend in person, regardless of the person using one of these just cause or emergency circumstances teleconferencing. Anything, questions before I move on to something a little less technical? Okay. Written material. I see you have some handouts tonight. Writings related to open session agenda items. That are distributed to all or majority of all of the members less than 72 hours before the meeting must be made available for public inspection at the time of the distribution to all or the majority of the members. So that means that at the time the majority receives the documents, such as the Brown Act PowerPoint that I printed out for you and gave to you, I put some right over here for the public. It was distributed to the majority and the public had access to it at that same time. Writings can be available for public inspection by internet posting and physical copies available at the designated office and meeting location. There is an exception for staff reports or similar documents made available 72 hours prior to the meeting by internet posting and office availability. That exception is complicated. And if you have a question about a staff report that you got in that amount of time, I do recommend you reach out to staff because it involves the staff putting it at a specific physical location in their physical office beforehand. Hopefully that doesn't happen, but if it does, it is complicated under the Brown Act of how to make sure that the public has that available to them. All right. The distribution of writings. If a writing that is a public record, which anything you have attached to your agenda is a public record, or anything distributed to you by the public at your meeting, likely a public record, if it was prepared by staff or members of the body, it must be made available at the meeting. And if it was prepared by some other person, it must be made available after the meeting. It can just be uploaded afterwards. Sometimes people bring documents, pamphlets, they have their own talking points that can get distributed. Staff can upload that. And all of that is subject to the Public Records Act request, which is sort of the sister of the Brown Act. And so it is something that keeping organized is to your benefit because it's ever requested, you know exactly where it was and it was uploaded and it was organized by meeting rather than it just being in somebody's binder and having to hunt it down. All right. Notices and agendas. Regular meeting agendas must be posted 72 hours in advance of the meeting. Special meeting agendas require only 24 hours notice. Teleconference meetings require posting at each remote location for 72 hours or 24 hours. Posting at each remote location for the 72 hour or 24 hour posting period. So obviously if you have a 72 hour meeting, it's 72 hours in advance, you're 24 the same. Agendas must describe each item to be considered in enough detail that a person of ordinary intelligence could determine whether the item is of interest. The essence of the Brown Act is public participation. They deserve to know what you're going to be discussing. It's not sufficient to have boilerplate descriptions. They should be able to understand what is going to come up at the meeting because they want to know if they should go to the meeting. All right, the importance of
just a quick question on that, or as far as informational items versus action items. Is it possible to take an action, a recommendation for this body on an informational item?
No.
But do we have to act on an action item?
No.
Okay.
Those are good questions. So a body subject to the Brown Act, such as yours, may not discuss and may not act on items that are not on the agenda or that are beyond the reasonable scope of the agenda description. So you might have an action item and it's kind of going off the wheels, but somebody has an idea of adding this consideration into the motion, right? But it wasn't agendized for that. You didn't agendize whether you were taking action on, you know, whatever that might be that was not described. That's a problem because the public was, deprived of being able to go to your meeting. So your action should conform to the action listed in your action item. And informational items must stay informational items, or else, again, the public would be deprived of knowing that they were an action item. Okay.
Could we theoretically make everything a potential action item?
I don't love that as a lawyer. One, because it's attempting to skirt the Brown Act a little bit by making it so you reserve the right to take action when the public can't say they were deprived, but it leaves a lot of ambiguity. Potential action items should say exactly what the potential action could be, and it would have to be done in good faith. All right, so some very limited exceptions that hopefully never come up again, but you do not have to notice your agenda in accordance with the Brown Act if there is an immediate need to avoid serious injury to the public interest. COVID brought all that out. Or if an item was continued from a previous agenda and the last meeting was within 5 days, probably unlikely that that would happen for you. But those are some exceptions to the noticing requirements.
So I'm just trying to understand. If there's a motion and it's very different from what was on the agenda, are we then supposed to suggest the very different motion be considered in the next meeting to abide by all the rules?
That's a great idea to say, well, you could say, we're not going to take action on this tonight because we want this to come back to us with this on the agenda. Or we can take action on what we've noticed tonight, and then we'd like this to come back to us with this specific action that we can't act on tonight. But providing, you know, direction as to what you want to see in the future to make sure that it's clean.
Okay, that's helpful. And then per the slide you have up, the second bullet, if we do everything we just talked about, does that conflict with this at all, or it doesn't apply?
It doesn't apply.
Thank you.
Well, you would still, let me just say, you would still need to put what action you were going to be taking, but what doesn't apply is the noticing requirement, right? So you could do that potentially if you have this serious injury to the public, 15 minutes beforehand because you're in such haste. But you still need to have a record that you took action on what you took action on. You still need that description.
That makes sense. And because we meet monthly, I guess, and we've said it publicly, we've satisfied all the requirements.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So, all right, things that don't need to be on the agenda. This is good stuff. Commendations, announcements, birthdays, requests to agendize future items. That doesn't need to be on the agenda. You can do limited follow-up to public to general public comment and then provide information or direction to staff. So I'm going to get into this, but with general public comment, you're not to engage with the public and ask them a bunch of questions and really dive deep on what they're saying because that's not on the agenda that day. That's on general public comment. But you can say, what was that you were talking about? And then say to staff, I'd like to see this on a future agenda. Okay.
Yeah, I just want a little bit more clarification on what this limit is. I mean, when a person comes forward from the public and says, I have this issue that I think sheriff's office is responsible for, X, Y, and Z, can we in good faith figure out what they are talking about? If they are unclear and they, like, can we in good faith try and figure out what they're talking about?
Well, I think that's what the limited follow-up is. And of course, there's not like limited means one question. That's not a rule. But I think saying, what property are you talking about? When did this happen? And then you can provide direction to staff if you want to see that come back. But the problem becomes when you're engaging with them and now you're having a discussion on something that's completely not on the agenda that day. And I don't know, maybe I'm that sheriff, right? And I didn't get to go to that meeting and defend myself and things were being said about me. Or just for an example, it just opens the door to having a meeting where your agenda is no longer being followed and there's over-engagement with the public on a general comment. So I would say keep it limited, keep it short.
But it is allowed.
Yes.
Okay.
So like example is the guy that's always talking about the fish. So if we go to him and we're all like, yes, we agree with you. We hate this. We're all about fish. You know, free the fish kind of thing. Is that bad? Are we not supposed to express to him whether or not we agree with him or?
Yes, I don't know about these fish, but I would say keep your opinions absolutely to yourself, especially during general public comment, right?
Yeah, but I mean, if I meet with him tomorrow and I'm like, tell me more, I want to hear even more about this problem, is that bad?
Well, the difference between that and this is that here you are with the majority. You're having a meeting, right? If you're meeting with this member of the public one-on-one, then you can absolutely talk to them, right? That's fine. The difference is the presence of the majority.
I guess what the importance, I guess, of this is, does this person with the problem with the fish warrant an agendized item? Can we figure that out in real time?
Yes. You could say, I believe that we should put this on an agenda. What do you think? And then you could have a discussion about whether to put it on the agenda, not whether you agree with them, just whether you think it should go on the agenda, right? Well, it would be during general public comment.
It would, okay.
Yeah.
I just want about the time, and this is my second meeting, so this might have been covered already. But when we have an agendized item and we're going to solicit public comment, are we supposed to be talking about it amongst ourselves prior to public comment? Or because I feel like in my first meeting, we had a very contentious issue where the board talked about it a lot prior to public comment. And I'm not sure that seemed a little, I don't know, out of order, but maybe that's fine.
So this is in a later slide, but what is supposed to happen is for an item is you've refrained from discussion until you've heard public comment. So you can ask questions as you were doing earlier to the presenter. That's fine. You can ask questions to them. And then you hear public comment. And then if there's any, and there doesn't have to be discussion. And this discussion means amongst you all, right? Then you have that discussion. That would be on an informational item, right? On an action item, you would discuss and then make your motion after public comment. Does that answer your question? Okay.
So on the fish guy, the fish person example, if there's that discussion you were describing about making it an agendized item, is that for the current meeting or for the future?
Future.
Okay. And then on Councilmember Tyler's example of the police report, that actually sounds like it should be just a standing agendized item because we know in advance the topics she's going to share. It's pretty much the same categories. And several times, several people have wanted to ask questions, myself included, but we can't because we're not following the rules. So am I missing anything?
Nope. That's something you could talk to the chair about.
Hey, chair, can we talk about that?
not during my item because it would be off of the agenda, but yeah, that would make sense. And honestly, I had that thought when that was happening, like that it could be an agendized item if you had questions. Prevents the questions. Go ahead.
I have two questions. So when you were mentioning earlier that we can discuss or propose a new agenda item, is that qualification specifically because it would be during open comment?
Right, because you don't want to engage with the commenter and you don't, correct, you didn't know the subject matter was coming to you.
Okay, I'm just right, distinguishing between this noted point in time where we couldn't do it because it's not agendized, but the difference is because we can't have that conversation because it's during open comment and otherwise not on the agenda.
So the difference would be that I'm not a public commenter right now, I'm a presenter.
Right.
But if you had a public commenter for my item, which who knows, we might if,
sure,
if I don't bore them to tears, then you know, you could decide in your discussion to put something on another agenda. That would be fine. But the distinction I'm making here about general public comment is that if you have a general public commenter, it came out of left field, it's uh-huh, not on the agenda, and that you are entitled to do something because you're not in an agenda item.
Right.
You're just in general public comment that you can add to the agenda.
But that left, out of left field comment, that would have to be at a different point. And the one that just came up, for example, that has to be noted in a different point in, yeah, time.
Yes. Like when he was like, correct, can we do this? Can we change our agenda? Yeah, absolutely. I don't have your agenda in front of me. Maybe there's a category for it after item, sure,
yeah,
three.
We're just talking hypothetical.
Yes.
I'm just trying to understand the distinction between the two. So in, yes, this instance, because it's not part of the current agenda.
Right.
Then.
Exactly.
Okay. And then I believe the example that Megan was talking about from the last session, and I could be wrong because we always have some dialogue that happens with different items, but with a presentation, during the presentation, we can potentially ask questions during that presentation, correct? And that potentially could have a lot of emotion behind it, but we could have questions, then the public would speak, and then a dialogue would ensue with the council. Is that correct,
yes,
from a timeline standpoint?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, if I can just synopsize what has happened in the past, CHP deputy would be here. Also, we did this many parking enforcements in your area. And then one council member said, well, where did you do them? Because you're not doing any parking enforcement in my neighborhood, right? So can you tell me where you're doing this parking enforcement? What about that?
That should go on a later agenda.
Okay.
Like at the end of this meeting, at the end of this meeting, could I request that we move the sheriff's report from being a public comment item to an agendized item so that we can have more of a dialogue?
I made note of that.
Be more specific about where these incidents are.
That's a possibility to take place today.
I would have to just see your agenda and see where you are in the agenda, but
there's not.
Sorry, there is a council comments section and announcements, and I think that the comments section would be possible. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Yes, that seems permissible.
Thank you.
Yes. All right. Rights of the public, access to meetings. The public has the right to open and public meetings with limited exceptions. They have the right to access to all agendas of public meetings and documents distributed to the legislative members, to audio and video record the meetings and to inspect the recordings of the meetings made by the agency, to attend without any precondition. For example, you cannot mandate that attendees give their names or register to speak. If they didn't want to fill out a card, you'd probably just have to let them speak. They can put whatever name they want. They could say they're Mariah Carey and you would have to let them speak. You can't demand their address. They're entitled to anonymity.
So what about that situation where you walk into a meeting, there's no instruction on how to participate and you can only participate by filling out a comment card. I don't have any comment cards. Public comment is closed.
Is this a situation where public comment was closed?
Yeah.
Well, it's up to the chair whether they want to reopen public comment.
I've just been at meetings where if you don't fill out a comment card, but there's no actual instruction of, hey, you need to fill out a comment card, and the only people that get to comment are the ones that fill out a comment card. I'm not talking about the planning commission because there's a table with instructions when you walk in. I'm talking about other, say, meetings where a comment card is, you know, required. Do you need to inform the public on how to participate in the public comment process?
I think it's certainly in the spirit of the Brown Act to make that available to the public at the beginning of the meeting and let them know how they can participate. And I would, you know, attempt to insist that they fill out a comment card and say, this is our process for doing things to make sure you're accounted for. But I would say, you know, the board at the beginning of their meetings informs the public how they can participate in the meetings.
But they don't need to fill out a comment card.
Well, honestly, you're making me regret saying that. What I'm saying is, when push comes to shove, the Brown Act does not say that the public needs to fill out a comment card. It's how we do things to keep things orderly. If someone said, I'd like to speak, but I don't want to fill out a comment card. I don't even want to write anything down on this. You should let them speak.
Can a body require that they do?
I think I just did.
Okay.
What about the online comments? Because I know sometimes we get multiple comments from multiple people, even though it's the same person with different names. So how does that work? Are we just allowed to theoretically someone, I mean, we've had examples of that. I think we all know that. Is there a limit to that? I mean, if they have four phones and they're calling us four times, yes. You know, is there any restrictions on that other than being annoying? Is it against any rules necessarily or no?
It's against the rules. You have to give people equal time. So if you're giving one person and you suspect that it is the same person and you have a good faith belief that this is the same person calling from a different number, you could say so and use that as your reasoning. But everybody gets equal time, right? So yeah. If you're giving somebody 12 minutes by accident because they're lying, then that is not equal time.
Did you say a good vague belief?
Good faith.
Oh, good faith. Okay, sorry.
Yeah. I would want to be really confident if I were to say, like, we know it's you. You know,
I think we're pretty sure who it is. Okay.
So there are specific types of public comment. We've talked about this a little bit, specific concerning items on the agenda and general public comment for those items not listed on the agenda. Specific public comment is an opportunity for the public to directly address the council on any agenda item, discussion, information, or action items. And this must occur before the conclusion of the item, discussion, or informational item. I'm sorry, discussion for informational items, or action taken for an action item, which we just talked about. And then general public comment can occur at any time in the meeting or at the discretion of the chair or the council majority, meaning it doesn't need to be agendized in a certain way, but it needs to be on your agenda, is limited to matters within the scope of the council's jurisdiction, even if not on the agenda. So somebody can't come in here and I always lose my topical references the second I need them, but they have to stick to what is within your jurisdiction. They can't come here and complain about North Korea's politics or something like that. That is not suitable for general public comment. And the members, meaning you, cannot discuss or respond substantively, which we just talked about with the fish person. General public comment is not required for special meetings. There's 24-hour meetings, 24-hour notice meetings. Those are just for a specific purpose, and you don't take general public comment for those. So rights of the speaker, the right to equal time, the right to criticize policy, the body, its members, staff. I note that the county does have an abusive conduct policy, which we're going to talk about a bit, which protects staff from abusive behavior. And the speaker cannot be disruptive, and we'll get into what that means a little bit. The limits on public comment up to a reasonable amount of time per speaker, for example, 2 or 3 minutes. I saw how you were running things earlier. That's impermissive. The reasonable limit on total public comment on an item before or during its consideration. So you can say we've got 45 people here and you know we want to be in bed by 1 a.m. So let's keep it at like 30 people or something along those lines tonight for public comment, right? You want to do that with discretion. You don't want to cut people's voices off. You might want to just do, you know, 1 minute each or something like that to avoid potentially unlawfully restricting members of the public. It is in your discretion if there are just so many people that it would be impossible to get through. But I think if I were doing that, I would err on the side of giving everybody a small piece of the pie rather than cutting it off at a certain number. It just depends on how busy it is, and that's up for the chair to decide. They are not entitled to a response from you on anything. You do not have to engage with any member of the public. You don't have to answer their questions. You don't have to respond to anything they say. You can if you want to, but you just keep that in mind. If you're being provoked, you don't have to respond. So controlling unruly speakers, the chair may impose reasonable time, place, and manner restrictions on public participation. Unruly speakers may be excluded from the forum if necessary to allow business to continue, but a warning must be given. This is a high threshold. If somebody starts swearing at you, you have to give them a warning. And then you have to say, you have to be able to make the case that, oh, we can't keep having our meeting because of this person. So if somebody is, I don't know, whispering swear words, it's a little bit different than if somebody's screaming them. You have to make sure that if you're kicking somebody out, that it impedes you from having this meeting. All right, we're nearly done with the Brown Act. So violation of the Brown Act is a misdemeanor when it is willful. That can include disclosure of closed session items, which we didn't talk about closed session because I don't believe you go into closed session. A willful violation of the Brown Act, action taken in blatant violation of the Brown Act, you knew it was informational, but you had an action item anyways, or if the member intends to deprive the public of information to which the public is entitled. Additional penalties besides embarrassment is it's voiding the action that was taken, right? Starting from square one, if you inadvertently violate the Brown Act and you take action and that recommendation goes to the Board of Supervisors and they act on it, but it was the basis of your potentially illegal Brown Act action, then you have to go start at square one, which could involve potentially months or years of work by staff and your body. So we wanna make sure that we are following the Brown Act to uphold your decisions. Also, you could be subject to injunction or declaratory relief to stop your violation. And if we're sued, the prevailing plaintiff may get their attorney fees and costs, which is quite a bit of money. Yeah.
Couple. Oh, go ahead, Taylor.
Sorry, Ray.
No, you go first.
Maybe you should have the same question. Sorry. I think about this in a corporate setting where we have D&O or some form of umbrella that protects us as individuals. But I don't recall being that as a a volunteer or rather member of the community, what protections, if any, do we have, mentioning that it's a misdemeanor for individual exposure?
So what protections do you have if you violate it?
Not that that's our intention, but yeah, I'm curious, is that something that then individually we would face or what?
That's interesting. Do you have personal liability? I'm kind of going on a limb here. I wouldn't think so unless you intentionally did something,
right,
where some allegations of fraud could be made or some sort of cause of action potentially by the county against you as a member. It seems pretty far-fetched because it's acting as a body and you'd have to.
So it would be the body in theory. If there was a violation, it would initially be the body that would be challenged against this versus right. The individual, unless we as individuals are violating the scope of our position.
It'd have to be pretty flagrant.
Okay.
And it would be the county that would be challenged. So. Right.
Okay. Thank you.
My questions were sort of related. So those additional penalties, those apply to the body?
Those apply to if we get caught in an action in a lawsuit.
To the count, do they apply to the county or to us as individuals?
I believe that's what she was getting at. It would apply to your action, so injunction or declaratory relief to stop the prevention. So if you decided something, then that action was going forward. So that would apply to basically litigation to stop what you've done, voiding whatever decisions you've made and having to start at square one potentially. And then the attorney fees and costs would be levied against the county.
Got it.
It's very unlikely unless you have a hobby of wanting to just violate the Brown Act flagrantly and make a clear record of that. But I understand being concerned about yourselves.
And curious, yeah. Thank you. I see you're going to ask a question. I had a question about unruly speakers. Do you want to ask about this one?
Has the county lost a Brown Act suit before?
I don't know the answer to that.
And okay.
I don't want to. No, I don't know the answer to that. There is a safe harbor rule in the Brown Act. So, which admittedly should be included in here, which is that if you know that you've messed up, you can redo it. And you can say, you know, oops, we've made this mistake. We're going to redo this action. We're going to rehold this meeting upon discovery of that. So if you have messed up, it's not as if like, you know, that's the end all be all. You can admit your mistake and restart.
That is helpful. Thank you. On the controlling unruly speakers, can we just play this through just so I'm clear? So a warning must be given. Mm-hmm. I think the example of the warning you gave was, your behavior is disrupting the meeting. We're not able to proceed. If it's a shouting match, they may not be able to hear us. And so what do we do in that situation?
In that situation, my concern is that your microphones hear you and that's it. So you've made your record, right?
Got it. Okay.
And the shouting will speak for itself.
Okay. Helpful. And then after the warning's been given, if they violate the warning, what do we do then in terms of removing them from the forum?
I don't recommend doing it physically yourself. You should call the sheriff.
Okay. Yeah. And is that staff that would help us? Just looking across the table?
She has a cell phone.
No.
You've had to do it before, though. You got to distract people and get them out of here.
Yeah, don't physically engage. Yes. Okay, so let's move on from the Brown Act, and hopefully this will go pretty quickly. But I'd like to highlight there's a new code, a new policy relating to the behavior of county employees or county bodies, and that's the Code of Ethics, board and commission members, that's who it applies to. And the abusive conduct prevention policy, these were just passed by our board recently. So the Code of Ethics for board and commission members, in 2024, County of Alameda adopted a Code of Ethics for all board and commissions. This is codified in our administrative code. And the goal is to ensure that promoting the common good is the hallmark of the decision-making process for all. There are 16 maxims that go with achieving this goal. I'm going to read them to you so you're aware that that is what our board is prioritizing. Actively promote public confidence in county government through your actions. Recognize and support the public's right to know the public's business. Involve residents in the decision-making process and welcome divergent points of view. Respond to the public in ways that are complete, clear, and easy to understand. Be a good listener. Carefully consider all opinions and points of view. Comply with all laws and regulations applicable to an appointed official and those governing the code of conduct meetings. I selected those maxims because they are most applicable to your council. And then the abusive conduct prevention policy. This relates to what we were just talking about, potential abusive conduct by the public. But the purpose of the policy, which was recently adopted, is to ensure a work environment free of abusive conduct. It applies to all county personnel, including interactions with contractors, vendors, clients, and the public. And the commitment is to promote courtesy, respect, and professional conduct in the workplace by all county personnel. Abusive conduct includes verbal abuse, derogatory remarks, insults, epithets, threatening, intimidating, or humiliating behavior, sabotaging or undermining work performance. Please note that a single act may qualify if it's especially severe and egregious. And it does not require a protected class element such as race or gender. It includes acts by or against contractors, vendors, and others affiliated with the county. There's no retaliation portion to this. So an employee is protected for reporting abusive conduct, participating in an investigation, or opposing abusive behavior in good faith. And if a vendor or employee or contractor engages in abusive conduct, a county employee or vendor or contractor, it may result in disciplinary action, including dismissal. So
meaning that, you know, if something were happening with the public where you felt that you were being harassed or there was some abuse going, you should report it. And that hopefully steps would be taken by whom you reported it to, including county HR, that this violates the policy that you're not being protected, right? So this applies all around. And it's being highlighted because it's a new policy, and you should have received a copy of it when it was enacted. If you didn't, we can certainly get that to you.
Is Tana the person to report to?
I think that you should notify County HR potentially, but I can get some clarity for you on that. Yeah, because I believe that you are considered under the umbrella of employee.
Have we already made you uncomfortable? Not yet?
Okay.
All right. And last but not least, the Levine Act. This is going to be a very abrupt shift. The Levine Act, also known as a pay-to-play law, is codified in Government Code 84308. It applies to officials in quasi-judicial proceedings, which sometimes your counsel is in a quasi-judicial proceeding, such as reviewing a conditional use permit. It limits contributions and required disclosure and disqualification. I'll go through that. Officials may not receive more than $500 in campaign contributions from applicants, agents, or parties with a financial interest. And this applies during the proceeding and 12 months prior. So if you received a campaign contribution, if you're running for office, and you received a contribution 12 months prior to something coming before your council, it would need to be disclosed. And also going forward, you're not allowed to. All right, disclosure requirements. If you've received greater than $500 from an interested party, which I just named, since January 1st, 2025, and I'll explain why that's the date, you must disclose it on the record. And the old amount, this changed as of January 1st, used to be $250. So if you'd received $250 prior, you must disclose it on the record. So the point of this is you could be running for office and you could be on this council and maybe an applicant gave you some money, right? You need to consider that if that would be relevant to any of the business that you were doing for that party. This is an FYI, you might have, dreams of running for office. This is being taught because most people don't know that it's such a small amount of money. Well, not that small, but seemingly. So if you do receive that, you are disqualified from participating in the decision unless you return the contribution within 30 days of learning about the matter. And then no contributions of greater than $500 are allowed for 12 months after the decision. This applies to applicants, agents, or any party with a financial interest. It covers all contributions, including reelection campaigns. And then it's pretty obvious, but why the Levine Act matters. Violations can lead to invalidated decisions. There can be fines or enforcement by the Fair Political Practices Commission, reputational damages, and the goal is transparency and fairness in land use and permit decisions. So I know that was a little bit of a veer, but good to know about what your campaign limits are.
I guess just to clarify, that's not applicable to any of us because we're appointed.
No, it's applicable to you. Applicable to you if you were to run for office and receive a campaign contribution while you're on this council.
Oh, like a different office.
Yeah,
got it.
Yes,
thanks.
Yes, exactly. Sorry, I didn't make that clear.
And just to be clear, this is only for if we're running for office, or this, which part of this is in general? Because there are limits, right, on what we can receive, what
right.
gifts.
This is if you're running for office. It's a campaign contribution.
What are the, okay, sorry to put you on the spot. What are the limits, if you remember them?
Oh, $500.
In general, not running for a campaign. Aren't we limited in what gifts we can receive?
I don't know that off the top of my head.
I'll take $499
then. When it comes to, I see on a lot of boards and commissions and city councils and whatnot, there is an item that comes forward and the person will recuse themselves, mm-hmm. and they'll, you know, they'll say how much or whatever connection there is, and then they'll get up and leave the room even. And then it's the whole deal of getting them back in the room because they're no longer in the room. And I mean, is that needed, or is it just, I'm going to recuse myself and not vote on this?
You mean, do they need to physically leave the room?
Yeah.
I think it's just a showing of propriety, like that this is, that they in no way took place in this. They didn't even give a look during the meeting, like, okay, really going to take action on that? I don't think they're required to actually leave the room, but I don't want to say that for sure. Maybe there is a requirement that I'm not aware of, because they could also just watch the proceedings on their phone, or they'll televise.
Right. Okay.
But maybe they just wanted to go get a cup of coffee or something.
Sure.
At the same time. Yeah.
Anybody else? Anyone else have anything right now? I just have I had a couple of things leftovers. One time this happened kind of inadvertently, but as EMAC members, if somebody asks us our opinion or wants our support for some project they're doing, if they want to use our name, that would be okay, but they should not recognize us as, you know, Diane Weidler EMAC member in support of whatever they're campaigning for, correct? Because that doesn't that imply then that the EMAC is supporting it?
I agree with that. I would be very cautious with that. I would make sure that everybody was okay with that being used, and that you as a MAC had expressed a majority support and whatever that was being used as. It's a little bit separate from the Brown Act, but this is why people call in to give public comment on behalf of their council and say, I'm not speaking for the MAC, I'm speaking as Diane, right?
I think we try to do that, but sometimes people might add that to their, you know, to saying so-and-so from such and such said this. And okay, I just wanted to, it just came up one time. The other thing is, you mentioned something about the discussion and making sure we had public comment. We never make a motion or vote on anything without public comment. But a lot of times in our questions and trying to get all the facts straight in our minds, we might have discussion amongst us first, and then we go for public comment, and then we might come back to make the motion. So it doesn't matter which order you do that in, does it?
You should, and I've seen it not done the correct way many times, and it's very easy to make a mistake or to forget to do that, but you should have your discussion, your substantive discussion, after public comment. So you're asking questions because you're considering the opinion of the public. That's the point in your discussion, right? You've received all the comment.
Okay. What you're saying makes sense. It's just a lot of times asking the questions sometime invokes the discussion at the same time.
Right.
Okay. And well,
imperfection is common when it comes to this. But often as chair, you could say, you know, okay, I hear us, we're getting into a discussion here, and I'm interested in continuing that after we have public comment, to just sort of course correct it and make a note that you want that to come back up later.
Okay. Thank you. Anyone else have anything? Any other questions for Melanie?
I just wanted to clarify on the Levine Act, it's only financial contributions if you're running for office that need to be disclosed.
Yes.
Okay.
All right. I guess if there are any questions from the public, I don't know if we have any public left.
Here.
Is there, I don't know. Well, 2 minutes should be good. Yeah, is there somebody online? Oh, okay.
Michael Fried, you're on the line.
Hi, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear
you. Okay, great. I'm just
tuning back into this discussion about, you know, Brown Act stuff, and I really appreciate your going over it. I was wondering if that, I didn't remember if there was, when I was on the council, if we had a refresher course like you guys are doing right now. Is it being brought up because of your pending elections and you know, choosing a chair and that stuff, or is it possibly because you have newer members?
I'm sorry, you just need to keep giving your comment, please.
Yeah, I just made my comment. I was asking whether this refresher course on the Brown Act situation, was that something that comes up periodically or during every year or something? Or,
well, I guess I can answer that. Basically, it was just an agenda item for tonight.
Yeah. Well, was that promoted by, was it a request though, or is it something that's supposed to be agendized on a periodic basis, like a refresher for the
not
for
periodic,
the council?
No.
It's not. So it's not a standardized format that you have to do it every once in a while. Okay. No, I appreciate it. And I really, and I forgot tonight when I was there, I forgot to announce who I was and where I was coming from. And I think that should be something that's not necessary, but maybe just a suggestion that people, when they call in or they're giving public comment, that they do identify themselves and where they're calling from. And also if they are calling just on their own recognizance or for some agency or whatever. So I appreciate that part of it that I just heard you were explaining, that you can make public comments, but you can't, you know, associate yourself with a particular agency or whatever. Anyway, I do appreciate it. And thank you for, you know, continuing on.
No more speakers.
Then we will close public comment. And thank you for the presentation.
Thank you. Have a good night. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. Okay, the next last item on our agenda for tonight is the election of a new chair and vice chair. Now, according to our bylaws, a chair and a vice chair's term is for 1 year. They limited to 2 years consecutive. So Warren and I have been chair and vice chair for this past year. We, per our bylaws, could only serve for one more consecutive year in these positions. And just to be totally transparent, a couple people have asked me if I wanted to be chair again. And I don't know, after hearing the legal presentation, I feel like I should say, I don't think so. but I just want everyone to know that the only decision I came to was I would not decline. But I want everyone to know that this should be a totally open process. And I think that I just wondered all of you to give some thought to who you would like to, you know, have lead this, be chair and vice chair for the next, for the year coming up. And the elections always happen in June. So it'd be from now, we would elect someone tonight, they would take over next in July, and then that would just repeat the process on that yearly basis. So, you know, just give it a couple seconds for each of you to kind of think about it. And then I'll just ask if any of you have any, you know, comments or thoughts. If you are interested or you want to run for something, you know, you want to do something, just don't. I want everyone to feel trusting enough so you can just make your thoughts, you know, knowing, because we have to trust and support each other while we're here. So I'll just give you a couple seconds to think about it and then see if anyone has any kinds of comments, and then we'll go ahead and do the nomination process, okay?
I'll say, since like half of us are on the newer side and half of us on the older side, that I continue to trust in you two or Tyler, people of this kind of the first generation, maybe. I think maybe it's too soon for any of the four of us to volunteer yet, so I'm okay with the way staying the way it is.
Anyone else? I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but if you have any comments or thoughts of your own, just put your mic on and make your comments.
My mic's on. I agree with what Elizabeth said. That's what I think as well.
I was going to nominate somebody, but if you want to go ahead, go ahead. Did you want to go ahead?
Well, I'll just add my comment and then I'll let you proceed with whatever you would like to. But I just want to say I have been on other boards and I just appreciate the work that you're both doing. I think you work really well together. It's not a perfect art form and we have to adapt. And, I appreciate you doing so. So I'm supportive of that continued leadership. So.
Yeah, so I would like to nominate Chair Weidler to be chair for another year.
So I just wanted to say we should hear before, we should at least see if there's public comment before we make and vote on the motion.
No speakers.
Are there any other nominations?
One speaker. Michael Moore.
I was looking at the materials for today's meeting, and I noticed on the form where it lists each of when each of you were appointed and what you are serving through. Four of you are rookies, or three of you are rookies, and four of you are veterans. Other way around. I get confused. I'm not looking at the piece of paper. But there was one thing that I didn't understand. Tyler, are you gone after 2023? Because it doesn't say that you have been appointed past then. Does anybody have that?
Well, maybe Tona could answer that.
Sure. Tyler's term has expired, but council members stay in the seat until such time that they're reappointed or replaced.
Okay. For the purposes of the ignorant public, that would be me. Knowing that, I think in light of transparency that you should say that, rather than having it sit there as your term expired in 2023 and you haven't been reappointed, or you have been reappointed, or you are subject to reappointment, or as of July of 2025, if you're not reappointed, you'll be gone. I think that's how I interpreted what.
Are you suggesting that there be something on the county website that says that?
No, on the piece of material that you give to idiot public like me.
What material?
I'll pick up the piece of paper. Just take one.
Okay, I'm not sure where that's showing either, but basically the term is for 4 years, but we can't serve longer than 12. And people keep their terms until such time as a replacement is found. So there's not really a time for somebody that has to leave. And we could all be dismissed by our supervisors at any time.
Of course.
Okay, so.
No, I understand that. I'm not trying to be a pain.
Okay, so we're, I'm just, is your point is that you were confused about how long our terms were?
Well, no, I was trying to figure out the election. I actually think that you are all doing a very good job. But what I'm also familiar with is, I'm trying to find the list. No, the listing is on the website where it says when you were appointed. And it doesn't say anything there. So my assumption is that you should all be here and it should say when your terms are up.
Okay, thank you. And Tony can make a note of that and we can
that information is on the website. So as staff we'll follow up with him, but okay. It is on the website.
Okay, thank you.
And I think it says term expired in 2023, correct? Okay, as long, I just didn't want to be crazy.
Okay, thank you, because some of us, I don't think, because we're here, we don't always look at the website for the information that's posted about our timing. All right, so there's been one nomination, and that was for me. Are there any other nominations?
If there's not more comment, then I'd be happy to second that. And Tyler, thank you for your service.
All right, so I guess you could do the roll call vote.
Councilmember Aston Nielsen?
Aye.
Councilmember Dragoni?
Yes.
Councilmember Maramahoko?
Yes.
Councilmember Roll?
Yes.
Councilmember Stanley? Yes. Councilmember Cushman?
Yes.
Chair Weidler?
Yes. No. Okay, well, yeah. Thank you all for your support. And I'm not sure if you're all just taking a step backwards again. But okay, so then we have to do vice chair. And unless anyone has any particular comments that you didn't express earlier, then we could either go, you can either make a comment or make a motion. All right, nomination.
If everyone is comfortable, I would like to nominate Warren as vice chair to continue.
I am comfortable and therefore would like to second the motion.
Okay, are there any other nominations for vice chair? All right. Is there any public comment for vice chair?
No speakers.
Okay, thank you. So then public comment is closed, and you want to take the vote on that.
Councilmember Aston Nielsen?
Aye.
Councilmember Dragoni?
Yes.
Councilmember Maramahoko?
Yes.
Councilmember Roll?
Yes.
Councilmember Stanley?
Yes.
Councilmember Cushman?
Yes.
Chair Weidler?
Yes.
I'll make a quick comment. Are we on? Yeah. Okay, so I just want to let you know, on every month, every Tuesday, what is it, the second Tuesday of the month, these are definitely my highlights of the day. I love this council. It is really fun. I learn a lot, and this board is just a riot. So I'm having a great time. Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Thank you all for your cooperation and for supporting Warren and I as you have, and we will continue on. And if you see or notice us making any brand violations, please just kick us under the table or let us know so we keep on the right side of the law. Next item is chair's report. I don't really have anything at this time, nothing that we haven't already talked about. Are there any council announcements?
I have a couple lanes reserved at Castro Village Bowl, and I'll see you all there in about 15 minutes.
I don't know any of you. I never want to see you again.
I just wanted to make a comment, actually, because I think as newer council members, a training like that was very helpful. While we did have some coming in, I don't know that everyone had the same necessarily, so it was nice to levelize that expectation and understanding.
I wonder, related to that, I was going to ask her, but it was too late. I wonder if we could invite her back and as an agenda item to train/grade us on how we're doing.
No, council is not available to come on a regular basis to your meetings. We're pleased that they're able to provide this training one-on-one. We used to do it as a special work session for all the MACs together and tried this as training, but they do not staff the MACs or the committees or the commissions. So they're not available to come back on a regular basis.
So
just to be clear, I wasn't saying regular, but even on another one-off basis, even if it's a year from now.
Well, we usually do trainings. We try and do them annually. I think that in the past we've done them both, you know, semi-annually and sometimes annually. But yeah, we will continue to provide an update to the Brown Act and all the things that apply to you on a more regular basis, which would be annually, hopefully, in the future.
Perfect. That's in line with what I was requesting. So
okay, good.
Okay. Anyone else? Just so you all know, Tony does keep Warren and I on track. She'll let us know if we make a mistake and do something wrong. I've gotten admonished before, so I try to make corrections as we go along.
So the rest of us are free to make mistakes then?
No, it's in your best interest not to. But we'll say something.
Anything else from council members?
Just another kind of like on the same idea of training and getting more information on how to make, I guess, decisions. There was a suggestion a couple months back that someone should train us, the advisory bodies, on what a variance is, or what when we get these planning applications, right? What a CUP is, or what a these sort of planning considerations, variances, CUPs, that sort of thing. How to find, make the findings that a variance is needed. I was just wondering, like my idea or suggestion would be like have a planning commission subcommittee come to the max as far as, you know, if we're not planners by trade, right, it might seem like something that's esoteric, but is that a possibility, Tona?
We've done that in the past when we've done Brown Act trainings. Part of it has been Brown Act, and then part of it is we'll pick like one of the applications, like a conditional use permit or a site review or something like that, and planning will come and kind of give an overview and a little bit of a training. We could reach out to them and see if they would be available to do that one-on-one versus in our larger settings, you know, with all the MACs. I'd be happy to reach out to the planning director and ask if they'd be available to do that in the future.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And then just one other thing. East Bay Regional Parks is having this like district-wide survey that I'm not sure if people from our area have filled out. Are they on our agenda or are they in the queue? And I'm not sure when that survey closes, but are they in the queue at least in the sort of short term?
They haven't reached out to be on your agenda. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, they have not reached out to be on the agenda.
Okay, so my suggestion for chair is to take to your agenda meeting, getting East Bay Regional Parks here to talk about their survey with us, since we are in the regional East Bay Regional Park District.
Okay, I did make a note to see if anyone had any future agenda items, and it sounds like that's a couple. Does anyone else have a future agenda item that we should make note of?
Yeah. I just want to make a note. Selena just indicated that the survey closes in July. So given that your next meeting is July, I'm not sure that it'll be a timely thing that we can bring forward. Selena, I don't know if you have anything to add.
Okay, Ashley wants you to know that was her.
Ashley. Well, Celine's one that was, somebody was reaching out. Anyway, it may not be, we may be too late is my point, but we'll check.
It's on, say it again.
We may be too late if it closes in July, so we'll check.
And okay. Say it
yours again.
I have put the survey in our
Okay, so the survey's in District 3's newsletter. Do you know what day it closes? 31st? Okay, so possibility maybe.
Okay, Megan, you had an agenda item?
I just wanted to make a motion to move the CHP's public comment report from, I guess, being public comment to an agendized item that we could solicit more feedback from in the future.
Okay, yeah. I don't know if we meet in, I don't think we really need a motion, but I did make a note of that. And when we meet with Tona, we can see if there's any reason why we can't do that.
My only follow-up question to that, and this is just more food for thought, is do we have a concern with agendizing it from their timeline standpoint? Because when it's public comment, they tend to be soonest. And so that means they can leave if there is need. So I don't know if that impacts things.
Done in the past, if I could just offer something, is they come under public comment and then like quarterly, we'll put them on the agenda where people can ask questions and follow up and spend a little longer time, if that's something that might be acceptable to you. I'm not sure. I'll check with them about her time with regards to being on every agenda and see if that's a possibility. But if not, I know for others, we've, you know, brought her, like I said, quarterly, where she can spend more time and, you know, a lot more Q&A back and forth.
I had a question. Is there any other training for new council members aside from the oath of office and the forms that we signed and the Brown Act training that we did today? Is there any other training to do?
Nothing formal.
Okay. And is there, you mentioned larger gatherings of other MACs. Is anything scheduled for?
Not at this time, there's not. Because what we normally do, or what we've done in the past with this Brown Act training, is brought all the MACs together, as I mentioned, and do more a work session that includes all of the MACs. And I thought this time we would try to do it. And council was also available to do more one-on-one, so it could be a more personalized kind of training. But we have nothing else planned at this time.
Just to repeat that for everyone on the call, there was a and repeat that there are additional training forms that are provided from by the board for council members to watch. The clerk of the board would have provided additional trainings. So,
Tonya, I just wanted to respond to your suggestion. I think it's reasonable to request monthly and see if quarterly is a default, is a secondary option if it's too much time from CHP.
Okay.
I wanted to ask a follow-up related question in terms of, do any of the MACs have a similar forum with the sheriff's office, given that we're under both jurisdictions?
The sheriffs do not attend like Castro Valley or Fairview monthly. We do reach out to them. They always give an annual report. They do attend when we ask them to. We could ask them to come, for example, and provide a presentation on like last year's statistics for the area. That's normally something that they come and present. You know, if you're asking for something different, we'll have to reach out to them and check their availability. But CHP has made it, you know, part of their work that they do come monthly.
Something along the lines of CHP to me would be very reasonable to request of the sheriff.
We'll make the request and let you know.
Thank you.
So just on this, would it be possible, Tona, just to move staff announcements, comments, and reports to either like right before or after the Pledge of Allegiance? And then in that way, we can have either, whether it's CHP staff or sheriff staff, available to, and maybe we can even put a time limit on it, you know? 10 minutes maximum or 7 minutes maximum or whatever. It would allow for that back and forth versus it being a public comment where it's not agendized.
Well, it would be agendized as a regular agenda item. Normally, the way that the agenda flows is presentations such as informational like that are usually first on the agenda, followed by, you know, planning applications and such. So they would be first on the agenda if it was agendized, more than likely, you know, unless there's something that's a priority or the chair wants to move things around. But, you know, that's what that would be. You know, your rules and procedures state that presentations are normally or suggested to be around 10 minutes. So maybe I'm missing your point, Tyler, but
I guess so. You know, it's agendized and the CHP officer doesn't have to stay for the entire meeting. Just have them be staff and just move the staff announcements to
no, they can't be staff. It doesn't work like that. They would have to be agendized as California Highway Patrol, you know, presentation on monthly stats or whatever it is, and be a specific item on the agenda. And, you know, that's what I'm going to reach out to her about and see if she wants, if she can do that monthly, or if we have to do where she comes in public comment and provides a quick update to all of you and then, you know, does the quarterly thing. We have to see, you know, what her availability is.
I think to Melanie's point, the reason why Tona is making that distinction is because if we put them under staff, it's considered overly broad. And so to the public, it might
No,
not
they're
be.
Not staff. I mean, they're not staff. We're staff. So that's why anything has to be, and the legislation has changed a lot more. Apologies if I cut you off. I'm sorry if I did. The agenda language has to be much more clear. And what?
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Staff is us. They're not staff, so it's a little. It's different.
I think what my issue is, maybe what other people are feeling, is that it's too vague. Maybe I feel like if she's just saying unincorporated, that could literally be in any of those places. So maybe if she just specified this many in San Lorenzo, this many, you know, maybe said mm-hmm. exactly where it is, that mm-hmm. could maybe be more beneficial.
Okay.
And maybe we could ask them for a little bit more.
More specific versus general. Yeah.
Yeah, because they have come to some HOA meetings, and sometimes we could spend the first 45 minutes of a meeting just with public asking questions. We right. would never get through our planning sessions if we spent 45 minutes or so just to get through a CHP report or something. So it's something right. to consider, but I mean, I guess just considering time-wise, we'd have to kind of be careful how we structured that change, a change like that.
Yeah, I mean, we really do look at each agenda and try and keep your meetings, as you know, within 3 hours. So if we have a heavy agenda versus not, that sort of thing. But, you know, we'll reach out and see what we can do. I do know when she does do the quarterly report, she does, I think, though I'll have to go back because I don't know that I'm remembering correctly, but I thought she did more specific kind of stuff and then also included general information about what's occurred, you know, during that current time. But I'll reach out to her and see what she can provide.
Hey, thank you. Anything else from you, Tona, or staff announcements?
Thank you.
All right. Unless any of the rest of you have something that you want to, any other chair report or board comment, I would ask for a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Thank you. Second? Is that a second, Warren? All right. Go ahead and call roll call. Do we have to do a roll call vote for this? Go ahead.
You don't need to adjourn the meeting by roll call. The chair has the right to adjourn, but you can.
All right. I think it's unanimous that we will adjourn at precisely 9 o'clock.
Good night, everyone.